welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 41. And this evening we're going to discuss the week that was April 26th through May the 2nd of 1987. I'm your host, Chris Zellner, and I am joined, as I am every week, by my great co-host and the man who does not love modern wrestling, David Bixenspan. Bix, how are you doing?
Wait, did I just mute myself by accident?
I think you did.
Oh, that's not true.
Well, that's
you missed
not what,
my reaction then. And
that's not what West Wrestling Twitter was saying.
We should just leave it in as that happened, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
Okay. But yes, I'm doing well. Otherwise, other than the darkness and emptiness in my heart from hating all modern wrestling.
I know it. Yes. Y'all be ashamed of yourself.
And we've got a second time guest today.
Yes, we do. And another great second time guest, a man who, of course, from his previous appearance, told us some great stories about Jerry the King Lawler, and he fits just right in on this week as Jerry the King Lawler is a prevalent part of this show, and the former president of the WFIA, Mr. Pete Lederberg. Pete, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. And, you know, after that last time, I reconnected with my old buddy, the great Brian Last, because of this. So, you know, we're all over that great thing, first, last, and security, Brian. But anyway, thanks, guys. Really appreciate having me back on.
Yeah, Brian, of course, Bix's co-host on the 605 Super Podcast. Great guest of this show. So, yeah, and Brian's become the quite the podcast superstar these days working with Jim Cornette. So yeah, you know, we it's good that we're reconnecting old friends.
Yes,
so that's a great thing to say about this show.
Yes, and of the two-time guests so far, another Hebrew, Dylan's yes. The only one that was not of the multi-time guests so far.
Yes. Yes.
Awesome. You know, one of the guys at work is talking about how there was only three of us at our school teaching. So, you know, I guess getting a little too smart to teach, but I digress. Anyway, let's talk wrestling. Not modern wrestling, right, Bix? Make it happen.
Well, this is Bix's favorite era, of course. I mean, this is what all wrestling should be like. In some people's eyes, it's important to fix, but
well, now I did want to ask you, Pete, just the timing. We happened to ask you on anyway, but dare to ago, Harry White, longtime pro wrestling fan in the newsletter scene for decades, passed away, and I know you were friends with him for years. So I just wanted to get some thoughts from you on him.
Harry was a great guy, and. It's one of those things, like you hear the expression that you can't find somebody to say something bad about them. And Harry was the type that everybody spoke well about. It's a little different than just not speaking badly about somebody. And he was one of the pioneers of the going to the fan conventions and just being hardcore, you know, fan. And, you know, before all the smart mark stuff came along and all that, Harry was right there, and he did get involved with the promotions as well. Terrible loss, a big person, and just wanted to say, you know, that you know, just my condolences to anybody that knew him, loved him, or was just an acquaintance of him and knew of him.
I should have mentioned exactly. I know there's a lot of people on Facebook that's been talking about it. I knew about Harry White anyway from back in the day, but, you know, I first really communicated with him, I guess, on the early days of the wrestling classes message board. And, yes, it's a you know, big loss for the wrestling newsletter insiders community to see him go. And, hey, we're getting old. You know, we're all getting old. So it's an inevitability of death. So the way it is. Well, let's move on to some brighter things. And we'll start this week with Jim Crockett Promotions. And this week, some interesting stuff going on. We'll first talk about the May 2nd episode of World Championship Wrestling. They just freshly off the Crockett Cup. they're getting ready to start the Great American Bash build. So there's things going on here. And one of the main angles that's going on is Ronnie Garvin and Jim Cornette, which has been going for almost the entire year. Ronnie Garvin had been burnt by Jim Cornette with a fireball, which turned Jimmy Garvin babyface in the process as he saved his brother. And they've been building up for the past few weeks for a cage match in Charlotte on May the 9th between Ronnie Garvin and Jim Cornette. Well, Jim Cornette was he was all agitated about this in the weeks leading into this particular show here. And Ronnie Garvin was out with Tony Schiavone cutting the promo talking about the match, and Jim Cornette decided to insert himself into the situation.
Indeed he did.
Oh, that great music.
The man with the hands of stone, Ron Garvin, very soon coming up in the month of May in the cage with Jim Cornette, and also you and Barry Windham advancing in the tournament.
That's right. Me and Barry are still in the tournament. I'm smiling because I'm happy, you see. I'm going to get finally what I've been looking for is Jimmy Cornette in the cage. And I got a towel here for him to cry on. Because, see, I don't have no soft spot in my heart for Jimmy Cornette, you see. Because, actually, I hate you with a passion. Because I think you're a sick individual. I know you got a few fans out there, but Charles Manson had a few fans also. I'm going to tell you, I don't mind taking a beating. I don't mind getting hurt. But when a man goes out of his way to burn a man's face.
I'm going to kill you right now. He put the towel around Cornette's neck, choking him. And they're tearing the set up. Here comes the midnight.
Hit him with the podium.
Yeah.
Barry tore the World Championship Wrestling sign.
Yeah, Barry told the World Championship Wrestling sign down. Barry went to make the save. This is a very Memphis-like angle, Vic. Yes.
Well, about that, Tony! Love it! Love it! That was incredible!
Incredible.
Jim came out, and Ronnie Garvin was talking about the towel that he was going to make him cry on.
Stuck in this thing.
It was like, ladies and gentlemen,
it was worth it.
Fans, we have a match for the U.S. Tag Team.
Like I was saying as it was going on, this was a very Memphis-style angle for World Championship Wrestling. I mean, there were sometimes you would get the brawls where the podium would get knocked down, but that was the first time I ever remember seeing the World Championship Wrestling logo get torn off the set and just hard-hitting shots. I mean, you could hear it on the microphone. I mean, the Midnight was just pounding on Garvin, and Windham come in, and that was a hot angle. And this is, you know, I'd say 3 weeks or maybe about a month after Stan joined the group. And Pete, you know, Stan, it took him a week or two to get, you know, into the role and the character, but him and Bobby gelled immediately after that. And regarding the Midnights, were you a Condrey Eaton guy or were you a Eaton and Lane guy?
All right. Well, I love Condrey and Eaton in the ring, but, you know, like everybody else would say, I would guess that Stan brought a little different charisma to the thing. You know, he had that time with Curran with as fabulous ones and whatnot. So, like you said, it took a little bit for him to get used to Bobby, but, you know, Bobby could work with anybody. You know, quick aside, too, that I was kind of wondering, just thinking about this, and there's a WFIA tie-in somehow. I'm wondering if the first time Jimmy Cornette met Ronnie Garvin was in 1978 at the WFIA convention, because we were in Knoxville, and Ronnie Garvin wrestled Boris Malenko in a chain match. And I know that they talked a bunch then, but it's just interesting to me. Like, I don't know why I just thought of that, or, you know, I'm looking, that's about not quite 10 years later, but just interesting stuff.
Oh yeah, that's it. I'm sure there was a. If it wasn't the first time, you know, it had to be one of the few times, because Cornette mainly, of course, stuck in Louisville, and he was like very young in 78. Would have been like 14, 15, maybe 16. So, yeah, I mean, that's probably a true deal there. And the Cornette Ronnie Garvin feud was fun. I really dug that whole thing. Jimmy turned babyface, and Jimmy got hot as a babyface from that too. Although it didn't do good at the box office, which we'll talk about in a minute. But Bix, I mean, we had Ronnie Garvin and Barry Windham as a tag team here. They were the U.S. tag champions at the end of 86, lost their belts in controversial fashion to Ivan Koloff and Dick Murdoch. They brought them back together here for a very short time. But, I mean, what are your thoughts about how Windham was being portrayed this time? Because he was getting title shots at Flair. He was working against Tully. He was teamed with Garvin. I mean, he was all over the place. But it wasn't a position like he was Magnum, you know, like, or in the Magnum position. What do you think about it, Bix?
He wasn't quite in the Magnum position, but Magnum never got to challenge the world champion in a time limit draw on TV, though, either.
That's true.
I mean, that's the thing, is that after his, you know, however long it was, you know, year plus in exile, it's once Dusty finally brought him back, I mean, it's not like he wasn't pushing him. He wasn't necessarily pushing him as much as someone you'd kind of think of as Magnum's replacement would have been pushed, but he was still getting a very good push, and this was a upper card program that headlined in plenty of places. So, I mean, I'm sure he was doing well for himself, and
yeah.
I'm sure Barry didn't have any problems with it after the last year of his life.
Yeah. Now, also on this episode of World Championship Wrestling, which the next match that they were leading into, there was a United States Tag Titles Tournament, which Garvin Win the Midnights were talking about.
You know what? Let me ask Pete something.
All right.
I'm sorry for interrupting. I just thought of it as you started talking. Being a guy in Florida, Pete, what did you think of Windham when he was... Yeah, I hate to use the word exiled, but that's kind of how everyone treated it. During, you know, what was pretty much, you know, 87's the end, but it was better than 86 for the most part, I would think, at least from what I've seen. But, like, as someone in Florida, like, what did you think of that whole situation in terms of Windham pretty much only being able to work there as far as any of the remaining territories?
Windham was one of those guys that, when he got it, like when he started, I mean, he was obviously, you know, kind of skinny, but then they had him work with Morocco, and you just saw that this guy was unbelievable. I remember him going over the top rope, and he got thrown over, and he's a tall guy. And I remember him going over horizontal to the top rope with his hand reaching down, and his hand was unable to reach the top rope. In other words, he was that high in the air, and he was amazing. And but the exile thing, I'm not sure exactly what happened, but like you guys said, he was amazing, amazing talent, and he's had one of the strangest careers I've ever seen, because you saw when he did the whole Widowmaker thing, and you know, later on, you know, all of a sudden he'd disappear for a while. And, it's just a very, very strange deal. Florida was, at that time, was starting to really go down. And a lot of people say, you know, you had the Eddie Graham thing, Dusty, but also bringing in, as happened in many places, the big guys. And, you know, you had them bringing in Crockett's guys and whatnot, I believe, at that time. And, you know, it was sort of like, okay, here's the major leaguers, and you know, why are you rooting for the minor leaguers when those guys weren't there?
Yeah, that's a good segue to what we'll be talking about in a little bit. Yeah,
now, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong. What happened was that that Dusty felt betrayed by when Barry left for the WWF.
Oh yeah,
and then wouldn't let him back in after he left the WWF. And meanwhile, the AWA didn't have enough money to bring him in for what he wanted to do or whatever, because he did work the one shot at Wrestle Rock. So he just couldn't, he didn't really have anywhere to go other than Florida. And now Was it on here that we had? Was it when we had Bo on that we talked about his going rate at the time?
Yeah.
What was it? Because it was shockingly low, wasn't it?
Wasn't it like 1,000 or something, $1,500 or something like that?
No, it was less. I thought it was in the hundreds for whatever he was asking. It was low, or maybe it was $1,500 a week was the absolute most it would have been.
Yeah. So he had to earn Dusty's trust back, and he did. So he got back in. But and more on Florida in a little bit. We'll get more into that one, because that what Pete was talking about is definitely a subject that's coming up. On this same
go ahead. I was just looking too, because pretty much you had that. You're talking about the May 2nd episode of WCW, but we're right about there anyway on this sheet. I'm not jumping too far, but you've got the May 1st Omni show, and there's Wyndham. I mean, it's fourth from the top, but it is against Luger. And that's a pretty big show there, too, because, Arn and Tully against Ole and Horner, maybe not, but you had Koloff in a chain match and Flair and Jimmy Garvin and whatnot in a lumberjack match, Midnight's Armstrongs and stuff. So Wyndham is seemingly getting, he's up there now. I guess maybe he had earned it back by now.
Yeah. All right. Now, the Bob and Brad Armstrong had the match with a New Breed on this episode in the United States Tag Title Tournament, which you need to watch that match, because you get to see the New Breed at their peak as far as workers, because Champion hadn't got hurt yet. And you get to see Bob and Brad Armstrong in a good little spotlight, and it goes to a time limit draw. Really fun match, so check that out.
Bob and Brad were a really good team during this period.
Yes. Bob especially was really good this time period. But the story is, after this, we get the Jim Cornette retort promo to what happened earlier. We're getting choked by the towel, and this classic Jimmy.
So we're jumping in at the finish of the Midnight's match, right?
Yes, there's a Midnight Express squash match against Larry Clark and Big Bill Tab, and Jim Cornette's cutting a promo afterwards.
I've got the cage match with Ronnie Garvin coming up.
Nice move.
I've got everything on my mind. I'm an upset. I'm not a happy man today. I talked to General Scandaragor. He's a happy man with Bubba. But that man ain't happy right there, because that's the kind of hurt that the Midnight Express
they just about
are going to be
with the double
on
goozle.
People here real, real soon. And I'm talking specifically about Ronnie Garvin. Now, if you got a slow-mo, I want to replay that.
Not the original music, of course.
It's a ripoff of the Kill Bill song.
That next week is a big day in my life, too, because next Saturday, right here on TBS, United States Tag Team Title Tournament, the Rock and Roll Express, and the Midnight Express right here on television. Hey, you know, everybody's against me. Everybody's got a conspiracy going. I asked for letters. I asked for a public outcry. You know what I got? Uno. One letter supporting me. Dear Jim, we have been following the conspiracy against you with shock and outrage. We know what it's like to be accused of all sorts of terrible things while, in fact, being totally innocent of any wrongdoing. We are sure the people of America will wake up and realize you are as a decent a person as we are. All our love to your mother. Signed, Jim and Tammy. P.S. His mother's still making those large tax-deductible charitable contributions. It don't matter. One person out there has the decency to be with me in this fight against Ronnie Garvin in the cage match next Saturday night. One person had the decency to be with me in the fight for the United States Tag Team Title. It means so much to these men. We're going to have the first step against the Rock and Roll Express right here on national TV next week. And mother, I promise you, we're not going to let you down. But Ronnie Garvin, I want you to realize
Stan is pretending to translate the promo into sign language, by the way.
Everybody, you tried to kill me in front of my own mother. What's his home in Louisville, Kentucky? And next Saturday night, unless we can do something about it, I'm going to have to get in that cage with you, and you're going to try the same thing with me, locked up with fence all the way 10 feet up high in the air, all the way around the ring, and me not being able to get out. Now, I want to tell you something right now, Ronnie Garvin. I've always been a decent person. I've told everybody I've never done anything intentionally to anybody, and you have this vendetta against me. You're crazy. You need professional help. You're a lunatic. But one way or another, I am not going to get in that cage with you next Saturday night, because if I do, you're going to put an end to me once and for all. Amen. And I'll never be able to get in the ring again.
Poor Jimmy Cornette. And we'll have more action when we come back.
We got that display.
Oh, okay.
All right. For those of you that don't know who Jim and Tammy are, Jim and Tammy is Jim. This is a 1987 reference.
After all, yes.
Jim and Tammy is Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. And they had a deal. They were huge televangelists, very huge. And this, they had done this deal where they were building their own theme park called Heritage USA. And they were on the air asking for donations and all this other stuff. And Jim had a big controversy as he was having an affair with his wife, with his secretary, who was Jessica Hahn. Of course, if you are a Howard Stern fan, you know who Jessica Hahn is. She did Playboy. She ended up marrying one of the guys that was one of the producers of Married with Children and all this other stuff.
And she also dated Sam Kinison for a while first.
Sure. And dated Sam Kinison, of course, in his videos. But, yeah, Jim was heavily involved with her. His empire came crumbling down. Divorced Tammy. He went to jail, got out of jail, and is in fact been back in the business for a while. I remember seeing him. God, he was on TV like 10 years ago. So he's back into the business, going strong, kind of like Jimmy Swaggart. You know, they fall down and they got back up. But
And Tammy, on the other hand, went in the completely opposite direction and became a hero of the gay community.
And became like a reality television figure. And she went all the way. Of course, she's known for she was crying all the time and heavy mascara, which would run down her face. And it was mocked on Your Saturday Night Lives and Living Colors and shows like that. I mean, they were a huge cultural deal in this time period. And also, Pete, you'll like this. The next week, Jim Cornette got another letter, and it was from Gary Hart. And I'm not talking about the manager, the politician.
Actually, you know, a lot of people listening to this are probably more familiar, would probably be more familiar with Jim and Tammy Faye from that SNL sketch with Phil Hartman as Jim and Jan Hooks as Tammy.
Yes. And Gary Hart, which I mentioned him and not the wrestling manager, Gary Hart was a presidential candidate who also had some extramarital things going on with Donna Rice. And I remember as a kid, all this stuff was all, if this was huge stuff in back then. In 2016 world, oh my God, it would be insanity. But
Gary Hart dare the press to find proof of him cheating on his wife?
Yes, and they did.
it just happened quicker today.
Yeah. Oh God, I can only imagine. But anyway, PWO, First and Only, just released their Greatest Wrestler Ever project, and the number one was, of course, Nature Boy Ric Flair. And in honor of him being voted number one, this is the only really thing we have on Flair this week, as Ric Flair cut a pretty damn fun promo on this episode of World Championship Wrestling. And let's hear from the Nature Boy.
So that's immediately after what I just played, right?
Immediately.
Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the world heavyweight champion, Ric Flair.
By the way, nice touch, I guess because of the set getting knocked down earlier, they're doing the interview in front of the ring.
Yeah.
Right here. Look at the women in this place. Look at the wrestling fans. Slick Rick. Woo! Style in and profile it. Not Nikita Koloff out here, bare-chested, showing his ignorance, telling the world he's a bad apple. Not Dusty Rhodes. Out here in a pair of blue jeans, cowboy boots, standing like this, thinking he's the best. No, it's Ric Flair. Woo! And I'm supposed to be a bad guy, huh? Check this out. This is what you call. Woo! Slick Rick himself.
This is the fans.
Of the rich and famous. And as I've said several times before, if you want to be cool in the world today, you don't go like this. Nah, you go like this. Because this means Horsemen, the four of us, Luger, Flair, Blanchard, woo, and Anderson, along with the mastermind, James J. Dillon, David Crockett, we are making you millions. And in turn, You are paying us millions, and nobody in the world today, woo, knows how to spend those millions on custom-made clothes, on Rolex watches, on long limousines, better than the Four Horsemen. One thing missing, and that's precious. You see, precious, everything in the world I've ever wanted has either been like this or I bought it. In your case, baby, the only thing keeping you from wrapping your arms around this man, from running your fingers through this golden mane, from showing that bodacious body to me firsthand, is that punk Jimmy Garvin. And I don't care if it's Charleston, West Virginia, Cincinnati, Greenville, South Carolina, Jacksonville, Florida, Tallahassee, Miami, Chicago, Minneapolis, LA, woo, or San Francisco. Jimmy Garvin, you're going to be just like Dusty Rhodes and Nikita Koloff and Ronnie Garvin. You're going to be just another guy. Just another guy that thought he could. You understand? I am the champ. I am Space Mountain. We are the Horsemen. And girls, I promise you, none of you can be first, but a whole bunch of you might be next.
Flair, the world heavyweight champion. Now, look what's coming.
Yeah, I mean, awesome promo by Flair, who's cut awesome promos in this time period. But the deal here is, of course, he mentioned Precious, and he's feuding with Jimmy Garvin. They just did the angle where Flair gave the fur coat to Precious, and she walked off with it. But, Pete, I always thought that was a weird deal because, you know, Flair always talked about the women he liked, and Precious just did not fit the Ric Flair vibe. I mean, what are your thoughts about that whole angle?
You know, that was a strange one. I agree with you. I guess the only thing they were going for was maybe that he wanted her and he thought he could get anybody he wanted. So, you know, just he was turning him down. So that was it. But it was strange. I agree with you. That the thing that always gotten me too, I mean, again, related but not related, was the whole baby doll thing as well. I did some reading on that, and people said, well, you know, Perfect 10, they were doing that to piss people off, because I was always going, Perfect 10 out of what? Like, out of 150 or something? But I digress. we're off topic again. But anyway,
but that was more Dusty pissed off. I mean, that whole baby doll deal was Dusty pissed off baby doll from Mary and Sam Houston. And that was to get her away from the baby face side of things. And then it all fell apart after that. But
yeah, well, let's not go too far. Yeah,
yeah, Precious. It was just a weird deal, although it led to that great segment a couple months later with Flair and JJ. But anyway, moving on. Another woman's about to enter the promotion. As on the May 2nd episode of Worldwide, JJ Dillon announced that he had hired a new personal secretary for Tully Blanchard Enterprises. And she will be making her debut next week. And Bix, this would, of course, become Dark Journey. How did you feel about Dark Journey? I mean, she was a Bayface in UWF. Last time you seen her, she was with Missing Link. And here she comes in as the personal secretary for Tully Blanchard. What do you think about that? How that played out?
Hey, she didn't really do anything.
No.
She just stood there. I mean, not that she was a great promo, but she was more involved with Dick Slater and also her stuff as a babyface in the UWF. And she was more involved at ringside, too, for that. So, it comes off like it was only because she was probably dating someone that she was using, whether it was she was dating Tully at this point? Like, she had been out of wrestling for the previous several months, right?
She had injured herself. She got injured earlier in the year, and she was still hurt then. But, I mean, she was able to stand at ringside, but who knows who she was going out with, because she has quite the track record of getting around the locker room in that time period. So who knows? But I just felt like, to me, that it was unnecessary to add her to the whole equation. That's too much going on. You're getting, that was getting like NWO territory there. You're just starting to add people into it. So
I remember the first time
I'll throw something in there too. Go ahead.
First time I ever saw the first
until you guys
games.
Mentioned it.
Hello?
Oh, sorry. Until
are we,
you guys
are we
mentioned
having a delay
it.
Issue or?
Yeah, go ahead, Pete. Go ahead, Pete. Go ahead, Pete.
No, I was going to say, until you mentioned it, I actually forgot to tell you how unnecessary it was. I actually forgot she was there, you know, all those years later. I'm talking about Dark.
Yeah, because she didn't last long. Like Big said, it was like War Games, maybe?
Well, that's what I was saying, that I remember the first time I ever saw the first War Games. It's like, wait, Dark Journey's there?
Yeah, it's like she was gone not too long after the bash. So, yeah, it was a real weird deal. Now, a couple of house shows to talk about. They ran Birmingham for the first time, I think, on April the 30th. Of course, Birmingham was continental country. And they drew 800 fans to the Bow Wow Auditorium, which Continental was drawing double that for their shows on Monday night. Think about that now. And Continental was not as hot as it was in this time period. And this was the card that they got. I mean, it's not a bad card at all. You got Ivan Koloff over Mike Jackson, Vladimir Petrov over Bill Tabb. You got The Bullet and Bob Armstrong and Rock and Roll Express over Manny Fernandez, Rick Rude, and Paul Jones. Ole Anderson and Tim Horner over Arn and Lex Luger. Brad Armstrong over The Barbarian. Nikita over Tully. And Dusty over Flair by DQ. But the problem was, reading the report from this, was that they didn't advertise it that great. So, yeah. I mean, and they were going to Memphis. They were going to Birmingham. They're starting to go into the markets they hadn't gone into before, when they were, I guess, still aligned with these other promotions. So now they're venturing out as part of their world domination plan, and not working out too well. And meanwhile, as they're doing this, they're screwing home up, because the Omni, the next night, they only drew 3,200 fans. And, you know, that's a 15,000, 18,000 building for sellouts. And here they are drawing 3,200 for this show. The New Breed over Jeff Sampson and Jeff Bell. Watch that May 2nd World Championship Wrestling show, and there's two squash matches, one with Bell against Luger, and Sampson was in a tag match against somebody. He teamed with Cougar J against Ivan and Vladimir Petrov, two muscle-bound guys who could not work a lick, and this was their only time they ever appeared for Turner. And they blew every spot in this match against New Breed, and Chris Champion got visibly upset in the ring. So, not good.
Were you at this show?
No. Baron Von Raschke over Thunderfoot, Vladimir Petrov over Jimmy Valiant, Midnight's over Bob and Brad, which was the best match on the show with the best heat, Wyndham over Luger by DQ, Arn and Tully over Ole and Tim Horner, Russian Chain match Nikita over Ivan, and a Lumberjack match for the NWA World Heavyweight title, Flair over Jimmy Garvin. So Flair and Jimmy Garvin not clicking right now. So, interesting. Now, like I said, Croc has taken over the world, or trying to, and they now have championship wrestling for Florida in the belt. And this is stuff about Pete was mentioning about earlier, we're about to get into. Dorph Funk Jr. is rumored to be coming in this week, but his name was removed from advertisements. So there's trepidation about him showing up. Well, he showed up. In fact, the next week he was there. So
And Terry showed up too.
And Terry showed up later on in the summer with some great promos. Now, this is what Pete was talking about earlier. The crowds here are very poor when the JCP guys aren't in town, as the TV has pretty much pushed the fact that these are the big stars, while the local guys aren't at that level. And Pete, you were talking about it. I mean, there was a deal there, and they did this in Central States. They did this in UWF. The Crockett guys were always seen as superior to the local guys, and that's a big problem.
Yeah, and you're starting with, again, at this time, which I guess people these days couldn't possibly imagine, but not everybody had cable. And now you're getting more and more, and you didn't just have the erosion just on TV. Now you're putting it right in their face locally. So, you know, where everything looks bigger because around the big superstation or, you know, up in New York or whatever it might be. And, you know, it was becoming more and more a world of two territories. I mean, we're going to hit Memphis in a bit. I mean, I know they kept going strong for a while and a few other places did. But, you know, that's what was going on is, you know, everybody did not have cable, and then more and more people were getting it. And then more and more of these guys were just taking over and running everybody else out. And I can't imagine that would have been their intent. But I don't know if it would have happened anyway, but that, you know, I've always thought about that. And I guess almost everybody would have.
But the thing is, I think, though, is, and see if you agree with this, is we talk about how weak 1986 was, and it got real weak there. This, you know, gave like a rebirth, though, to Florida. Because Dusty started coming back in a lot more, and so you got Dusty, you know, working the loop, and you know he's the king of Florida, so it has revitalized it. But when they're not around, it's different. I mean, would you agree with that? That it was better than it was in '86.
Yeah, absolutely. But you could tell. I hate to say it this way, but I'm pretty much on death's door, though, you guys were talking about earlier, because you brought him back. Yeah, you popped it a little bit, but then here we go. Now you're making – and he's not coming alone. Let's put it that way. And, you know, you come with all these other guys, too, and then when they're not there, what are you going to have?
Yeah, well, they're trying. As you look at this April 28th show from Tampa, which drew 3,000 fans, which – was significantly better than the previous Tampa show that didn't have the Crockett guys on there. And you got, I mean, here's your matches. You got Ken LeWino over Rick Ryder. You have Jimmy Backlund, of course, Jimmy Del Rey fighting Jerry Gray to a draw. Ron Simmons over Shaska Watley. Ed the Bull Gantner over Colt Steele. Scott Hall over Randy Mulkey. Jimmy Vann over Bill Mulkey. Tahisha Prince, who is Samu, over Jammin' Mitch Snow. Southern Boys, Jimmy Valiant over T.J. Conn and the Mod Squad. Then we have this match. Dusty Rhodes and Mike Rotunda over Kevin Sullivan and T.J. Conn. Dusty Rhodes was destroyed after the match until Ed Gantner made the save. And it looks like Dusty is trying to redo his babyface turn with Gantner. Meaning that here's how everything's played out here. Dusty is playing the role of Eddie Graham. Mike Rotunda is playing the role of Mike Graham. And Ed Gantner's playing the role of Dusty. All this is circa 1974. So they had big plans for Ed Gantner. But Pete, Ed Gantner was a guy who he just wasn't very good. And he wasn't around too much longer after this. Why do you think that they were trying to push Ed Gantner? Was because of his size and his look?
Yeah, you just said it all. He really wasn't good. And exactly, size and look. They were trying any guy that looked, you know, really, you know, everybody's trying to create another Hulk Hogan, let's face it. And anybody with any size and look, I mean, they had Luger first, don't forget. Yes. So Gantner was shortly thereafter.
And Scott Hall's here,
they were
too.
Trying whatever. Yeah. But Scott Hall came in, and I remember The Office talking about how his attitude now, people are going to laugh about this now, but his attitude was completely opposite of what Luger was. He did what he was asked to do, no attitude, no prima donna stuff. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting contrast to what came later. But Gantner, yeah, though, just to me was no talent. You know, guy had muscles on top of muscles, of course, and they were just trying to push him. I really think it was a desperation by just trying to push, find someone that was going to work, and everybody's trying to find their next Hulk Hogan, as I said. And he had no charisma as well.
Yeah, not very good. And then we had this match, which was the main event. Barry Windham and Ric Flair by DQ for the NWA World title, shown on television, and although they ended it in progress, of course they got to, this match was said to have been better than the Crockett Cup match. Now, Bix, have you ever seen this match?
I don't believe so. I've seen a decent amount of stuff with the Crockett guys on Florida TV from 87, but I don't think I've ever seen this one.
Pete, you remember this match in particular?
Not in particular, but I guarantee you, you know, obviously those two would be good, but you know, it could be Barry's in his hometown.
Yes.
And obviously not, you know, that type of thing. And, you
better
know,
heat.
Like you guys said, he's still trying to better heat. Yeah. Yeah. And people knew Barry as, you know, maybe it's more people believe that he had a shot at winning there yeah. than they would have in the other place, you know?
That's a good call. That's a good call on that one. And in your last bit of Florida news this week, there's a new young Samoan babyface that is going to work the prelims named Coquina, who Dave Meltzer said may be the brother or cousin legit of the Tahitian prince. Coquina weighs 375 pounds. Of course, Coquina is Yokozuna. And he is the brother of the Tahitian prince, Samu. So, yeah, and this was the first time I think he actually got work in the business, because he would bounce around various territories eventually before and then going to Mexico and Japan before becoming Yokozuna. But he was a guy that had talent and could move around. And I was always surprised that nobody else picked him up earlier. When you say Bix, I mean, I think AWA brought him in as Coquina Maximus. But he should have got a bigger spot before Yokozuna, wouldn't you think?
It was weird. I mean, he, outside of Japan, I mean, it's not like he ever got a big push in Japan. I guess UWA would have been the biggest push he got, right?
Up until the, yes.
Yeah. So it's weird that he really didn't get, like, I'm trying to think. I mean, he was as a worker, he was better as Yokozuna than he was when he was younger, as far as psychology and selling and all that. But he was so much of a better athlete, and he also wasn't being encouraged to gain weight. So it's weird that no one else picked him up and tried to do anything with him pushing him, because, he was very good, at least from the beginning.
Yeah.
And I saw him in the Continental with Eddie Gilbert as well.
Yeah, Continental wasn't a big push. Memphis, he was right. out within a few weeks. Where else did he work during this? I think he might end up in Central States a little bit, right?
AWA
was his biggest push stateside.
He worked for WOW.
Yes.
That worked there.
And Sika was in Continental when he was there, too.
Yeah, it was a tag partner. Yep. With Mr. Alan Martin as their manager.
Yes,
although their original manager was Brother Ernest Angel. But that's a whole nother story for a whole nother show.
Pete, do you remember what Eddie thought of him back then when he was booking and brought him in?
Yeah, he, you know, potential. And like you said, I was there when he was with, actually, I guess Sika was with Brother Ernest Angel. I don't even remember who Coquina was with, and I'm trying to remember if he used that name. I'll think of it later, but
yeah,
he
did.
Okay, yeah, but he saw potential in him, and I don't, but again, I left shortly before Eddie did, actually probably right around the same time, because I remember that whole Road to Birmingham thing, and I don't know that Samu or Coquina didn't leave right about the same time.
Yeah.
And do you know that? Is that about right?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like all the 80s guys were bouncing
yes.
out around that same time.
So here. That could be, you know, I really, Eddie would use someone if he didn't believe in them, you know, so there you go. And, you know, it may be he got the, I don't know if he saw him before or if he got the job as a favor from Sika or what happened, you know, but it was short-lived there.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the Universal Wrestling Federation, which, of course, is also under Jim Crockett control. And JCP has decided to run two sets of tapings on May 2nd and 3rd and on May 16th and 17th. But that would be it for shows for this promotion during the month of May, as they reboot the promotion to fit how they want it to go. Now, as far as talent, it looks like Yes. As far as talent, it looks like Dr. Dusty Williams will be staying after all, after it looked like he's going to be WWF bound. But no one is sure what Ted DiBiase is going to do yet, but he is booked for the May 2nd and May 3rd tapings. Williams also canceled his New Japan tour for next month as well, and Scott Hall will be replacing him on the tour. Now, of course, DiBiase did attend those tapings and a very memorable promo on the May 3rd taping in Tulsa, where it looked like he was starting off his heel turn, and then that next week he signs with WWF and made probably the best decision of his life. But, man, like we talked about on the Death of UWF shows, Ted DiBiase as UWF champion leading the UWF charge against the NWA would have been one of my all-time favorite angles if it happened, Pete. I mean, Flair and DiBiase meeting in the end at Starrcade 87. I mean, that sounds perfect.
Sure does. You know, still kind of burns me and galls me a little bit the way that they what they did to the UWF after they bought it. Just unbelievable that they buried everybody. I mean, obviously not Sting, but you know what I mean. Sting just caught on because of that one show, and then they gave him a push. But and rather than doing an invasion thing and just, you know, burying those guys or making them look minor league or whatever, unbelievable.
Yeah. Now, more news on the talent. One Man Gang is definitely into WWF, with the plan is for him to become Hulk Hogan's next big challenger this summer. And it looks like Sam Houston and Bruce Prichard will also be going. Chavo Guerrero and Savannah Jack are also definitely out of here. Now, Bix Gang didn't become that Hogan opponent this summer. They, I think, stuck mainly with Andre and guys like that.
I don't think Andre worked. No, Andre didn't work between WrestleMania and Survivor Series.
That's right. That's right.
No, was it Gang? Maybe he didn't work as many shows as expected, but Gang worked with Hogan that summer, I think.
Yeah, but he wasn't the big challenger.
Who was the big challenger that summer?
Oh, let me see. Was it...
You know what? Maybe there wasn't a big challenger, because that's also when he would have been feuding with Killer Khan, right?
Yeah, so maybe...
So they were just rotating different guys in.
They were, yeah, they were bringing guys up, because see, there's Killer Khan, and I think Hogan was taking some time off as well in this time period. Savage for a run. Khan. There's Gang. Harley Race.
Yes,
he was
that's right.
Being with Harley Race. So he was going with different guys, basically what it was. Kamala. So
I thought Kamala was earlier in the year.
It was June. He was being with Kamala in June. So... different guys. Now, Terry Taylor started his heel turn on the Fort Worth tapings by slugging Steve Cox during an interview. Eddie Gilbert then asked Taylor to join Hot Stuff International, but he turned him down. Now, on the tapings the day after in Tulsa, that's when he has a match with Chris Adams, Paul Drum on the floor. And, Pete, this is like the rebirth of Terry Taylor here. As, you know, he had been that, you know, top baby face for a while, kind of floundering a little bit, and now he turns heel and he becomes really great in this role for the short time he had it.
Yeah, he did. And you know, it's real hard to be that second baby face, but when you're like the third or fourth one, even harder. And I think being a baby face is probably one of the hardest things to do anyway. You know, what do? You know, and especially when you have to sit there and think, okay, I can't get too over, but, you know, they'll hamstring you a little bit, you know, tell you can do this, but you can't do that. You can say this, can't say that and whatnot. And, you know, you're treading water and, but being that, I believe he was about third, right? And then, yeah, he really looked good at this time and it really breathed new life into him.
Well, at one point he was fourth. When Duggan was there, because DiBiase, right, Doc, right, and Duggan were all ahead of him. So, yeah, he had like got the third by this point. But, yeah, and this breathed new life in, like you said. And, of course, he would hook up with Gilbert. And they had a very good run right after this. The TV tapings this weekend had a lot of extremely short matches, which made sense because it was Dusty, Crockett, and Dylan running the show, but they were running the JCP tapings. And the old UWF tapings, yeah, they had squash matches, but it wasn't like this. All right, let me tell you the list. And this is for one taping of television, if I'm not mistaken. I think it may have been two. It was 2 weeks. But listen to all these matches. Barry Windham over Super Ninja. Rick Steiner and Sting over Glass Man and Hank Wilburn. Vladimir Petrov over Kim Massey. Chris Evans over Craig Whitfield. Iceman Parsons over Jeff Raitt. Steve Williams over My Boy Yet. Big Bo Rogers on a handicap match. Petrov over Raitt. Windham over Gary Young. Chris Adams over the Thunderbird. Steve Cox over Super Ninja. Another handicap match for Bubba. Rick Steiner and Sting over Glassman and Bobby Howell. Dr. Death over Ron Ellis. And then you had two dark matches. Bubba over Barry Windham by count for UWF title. And then UWF tag titles. DiBiase and Doc over Rick Steiner and Sting by DQ, which may have been DiBiase's last UWF match. But, Dix, that's a lot of matches here and a lot of very short matches. And Power Pro Wrestling and UWF was really fun television, and then once Crockett bought it out, yeah, they still had some fun moments, but it was never the same.
Yeah, I mean, UWF still had some good stuff. Power Pro, after that one point, was pretty god-awful.
Oh, yes.
Especially during the summer. Power Pro became pretty much all squashes.
Yes, it was bad. And they had moved... Was it Jim Ross was not at ringside anymore? Or something
like
that.
No, they moved them to ringside.
They moved them to ringside, that's right. And they changed the look. They eventually got out of Fort Worth altogether and started going around the different little towns and stuff.
Yeah.
Which, and you know, was fine for some, because some of those crowds were real hot. But, yeah, they neutered it in a way.
Well, and it was weird, too, because they were still using Watts' as production people.
Yes. Yeah.
And did until, if not the end, then, like, right before the end.
I think once they took that hiatus in the summer is when it changed.
Hiatus?
Well, they quit doing the Power Pro and went to the studio shows.
Oh, no, that was the main show because of the WPIX thing.
Yeah, Power Pro was doing that too.
Oh.
If I'm not mistaken.
Oh, right, because it became a recap, because they do the thing like when they ran the Reunion Arena show.
Yeah.
On TV, it's like, okay, we're here now in Dallas, Texas at Reunion Arena. I'm Jack Gregory. The man that no one knows anything about.
Yeah. And, then they start taping in Crockett Towns after that. They very rarely went back to the Watts Towns. But, yeah, it totally changed television. Now, this match here, this is one of those matches where if we could only have the handheld for this one. Eddie Gilbert and Sam Houston supposedly had a tremendous match on April the 28th in Albuquerque that went 46 minutes and 17 seconds with Gilbert going over. That sounds awesome. And Pete, you know Eddie Gilbert well. Sam Houston was a guy that he brought in to Global when he was booking there, and they always worked well together. Sam was one of Eddie's better opponents.
Yeah, well, Sam was an interesting character when you see. I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure everybody would know the Stanley lineage there, but he was very skinny. But he could work. And thing is, Eddie was kind of a smaller guy, but with Sam, he could play more of a tough guy, if that makes any sense, because Sam was so skinny. And, it looked effective, and they worked really well together, right?
Do you think there was some sort of simpatico there with both being sons of famous wrestlers and stuff like that? You think that may play a role into it?
Yeah, absolutely, because Eddie was very into history, and definitely with every single thing. You know, you look through his whole career, he started against Ken and Buddy Wayne, and Eddie was just a huge, huge wrestling fan, historian, anything you want to say. So he definitely respected that type of thing when someone had family in the business. So for sure, you're definitely right on there, I would say.
And now let's do our international section this week, because, of course, with this time period, not a whole lot of things around your non-Japanese wrestling world in the Observer or other newsletters. So, it's basically Japan and one little bit from the United Kingdom. But let's start with All Japan. And they ran a special show at Sumo Hall on May the 1st in front of 2,200 fans. It's a special TV show type deal. So it's a one-off show. And yeah, that's a lot. That's not a lot of people. But yeah, they were doing a special deal. It wasn't a stacked show. So, and they were doing another one, I think, the week after. But this featured the debut of John Tenta, who teamed up with Giant Baba to defeat Rusev Kimura and Goro Shirumi. And this also had the debut in an exhibition match of Raja Lion, whose real name is Ryo Ohose, who was 7'5", 375 pounds, is a kickboxer from Pakistan, and he did a demonstration building up to a future match with Giant Baba. Bix, tell it. Enlighten everyone on the greatness of Raja Lion.
This is on YouTube, right? If the match isn't, there's at least some kind of clips, right?
Yes.
So, as described, he was a karate master slash kickboxer of some kind from Pakistan.
It's on YouTube. June 9th, 1987. There's one video that's got the match total, and there's one video up under it saying, World's Greatest Wrestler, Raja Lion.
Isn't there also clips of the exhibition, too, from this model show?
I'm looking, but go ahead and talk.
There may also be, like, a workout clip or something. Anyway, he has this match with Baba, and I guess I'll explain how it went first. He blew every spot, including his wacky kicks, fell down, crowd laughs. I have heard, though, and I'm trying to remember where was this from. Was this maybe from Heese's site? Do you know where I'm going with this?
Vaguely, but keep on.
That Baba booked this as a parody of Inoki's mixed matches.
That's what I was thinking.
Because it doesn't make sense otherwise.
Yeah, Inoki was having, you know, all of his weird stuff over the years. It makes sense, but that's so unlike Baba. You know, that's so out of what he does. It's different.
Right, you know, and Baba doing a comedy match like that makes more sense than Baba randomly booking himself against this man.
Yes, that is true. And John Tenta, of course, trained in the All Japan Dojo, was sumo guy, you know, have wrestled amateur over here at LSU, lost to death as an amateur. And in fact, if you watch old Mid-South Wrestling episodes, Bill Watts would talk about John Tenta on the air in 1982. And he made his debut here in All Japan, and he got over pretty good in All Japan, Pete. And of course, you know, he would become Earthquake and stuff like that. But we talk about Kokina as a, you know, big dude that can move around. John Tenta, big man who was really athletic for his size.
Yeah, definitely. Interesting dude, you know, and that's his debut out here. So he really could move, and I don't exactly remember his exact background, but it was sumo, right?
Yeah, he was. That's how he got in All Japan. Well, yeah, he went sumo.
And yeah, you know, to do that, you know, you think giant guy, but they really do have to have some agility. You know, people don't really realize that. I don't believe, you know, a lot of times when you think of sumo, you think of two guys just leaning on each other and using their weight and their size. But the really good ones do have that agility. So I don't know. Well, he must have some other sort of background.
Yeah, Wajima was around at this time period getting the push, and he was god awful. And you're like, how is this guy a sumo star? He's terrible.
Well, the other piece is, too, that you could have the size, and maybe the other point is maybe his attitude was better. Maybe he actually learned the craft instead of just, you know, I heard from Bellagima was that he had the attitude that he was a superstar in sumo, so he should just be a superstar in wrestling. And he was the guy who got on the microphone and tried to expose the business, right?
Yes. Yeah, what a...
He didn't I'll tell you what you need to know about him.
Yeah.
By the way, I did just look it up. There is a video online. It looks like it's from Korakuen Hall, though, of Raja Lion in an exhibition. If you Google, it looks like it's not on YouTube. It's on some other video hosting site. It's titled Raja Lion versus the skinny early 80s Memphis era Jimmy Hart looking motherfucker.
Is that how it's titled in the thing on YouTube as well?
Yes. On whatever the site is, yes.
Hilarious. Well, as All Japan's doing all this.
Oops.
Oh, boy. As All Japan is
that was
got this wackiness going on, New Japan had just run a show at Sumo Hall on April 27th, which drew 9,880 fans in a $465,000 house. And your lineup for this was Masa Chono and Don Arakawa over Riki Basan and Shoku Kim.
Shoku Kim, I presume, was one of the other strong machines along with Basan and
Harada.
Juji Harada. And who's the what? There was a fourth one, too, right?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Was that another Korean wrestler?
Probably. Okay. Matt Bourne over Kentaro Hoshino, which sounds like an awesome match. Kazuo Yamazaki over Shinya Hashimoto, which could have been an awesome match. Ray Candy and Bad News Allen over Seiji Sakaguchi and Daryl Peterson, who, of course, is Max Payne.
That is a match.
Yeah, that is a match. Jake Murdoch over Yoshiaki Fujiwara in 21 minutes by DQ.
And then we have this. Friends, weren't they?
Yes, and that was a good match from what I remember. And then we have this one. Shiro Koshinaka and Kingo Kimura beat Akira Maeda and Osamu Kido with Kimura pinned Kido. During the match, Koshinaka broke his leg and will be out of action until July at the earliest. Not good for Koshinaka. And he missed the IWGP League of next tour.
And he was starting to get a big push here, too.
Yes. Tsumi Fujinami beat Bam Bam Bigelow by countout after Bigelow took out Larry Sharp on the floor. Larry Sharp, of course, was managing Bigelow in Japan as well and was pretty over in Japan.
You should have called him Crusher Bam Bam Bigelow.
Yes, I should have called
his name here.
Yeah. And then we have our main event. Antonio Inoki beat Masa Saito by technical knockout in 26:02 after Hiroshi Hase came out and handcuffed both men together. And Inoki jabbed the cuffs in Saito's face, forcing him to juice like crazy, where Hase threw in the towel. After the match, Hase and Tatsumi Fujinami were helping Saito to the back, when Fujinami walked by Riki Choshu, who was sitting in the crowd. And Choshu decked him, which got the press all in, which got press all in all the magazines and newspapers. Now, Choshu has been cleared to wrestle New Japan now, so Dave Meltzer expects the next tour to be red hot. Yeah, he had just got the clearance after leaving All Japan that he could wrestle New Japan, although not on television yet. But, Bix, this is a huge deal here. Choshu coming back in.
Is that the no rope match, the Inoki Saito match?
No.
Because I know that has Choshu doing stuff too.
I don't think so. I'm checking to make sure.
Because I don't remember Hase in the handcuffs, though. Because I feel like I've seen the no ropes match.
Let's see. No, that's not the one.
But I mean, I'll get back to Choshu in a second. The feud with Saito was really the end of your like classic superheated Inoki main event type of match.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
But yeah, they're not all great matches, but Saito's still great, and this is probably the best Inoki looked after the health problem started.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the island match is there, but I mean, this is a hell of a damn match. Yeah. And I think it is a no rope match. Now I'll look at it.
Okay.
I'm making sure because none of the wrestling results sites have it listed as that way.
But so, you know the match I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, though, Choshu coming back is a very big deal. Because now he also has all these fresh opponents too with the UWF guys in. I mean, he's going to have the Inoki stuff first, but he'd been gone for, I guess it's 2.5 years, pretty much almost exactly 2.5 years, right?
Yeah, he's just out of jail.
No, I said Choshu, not Choshu about and Saito. The other guys. Okay.
I'm talking about Saito was just out of jail. Choshu and Kobayashi were in the crowd for that. So Kobayashi was with him. Yeah, all the guys had just left from vacation. They had all went with Choshu to Saipan Island, where Choshu got married, which was shown on television and got huge ratings. But now this is them all coming back in New Japan together.
Why was Saito able to start back before the other guys?
Because he
was, oh, right, because he didn't have a contract or anything.
He didn't have a contract. Yeah, he was in jail.
That's one way to get out of it.
Yeah. That is one way to get out of it, I'm sure. And
well, did Choshu coming back cause heat with the UWF guys?
In a way, but it really caused heat with Fujinami, as I'm about to tell you. Well, rumors on Fujinami is very upset about Choshu coming back, and he feels like he is being downgraded. Dick Murdoch is upset as well. He's full of the idea out there about going back to All Japan, but Giant Baba is denying it. Now, Pete, Choshu and Fujinami, they had this love-hate relationship for a while there, and eventually when Choshu comes back, they kind of smooth it over and become really great friends again. But I can see where Fujinami's coming from here. They had just done the angle where he's now going against Inoki, and here comes Choshu to steal his thunder.
Yeah, and, you know, Fujinami had a long, long time getting there when you think about it. So I totally understand where he's coming from. I'd also say too that in my opinion, other people probably disagree, but I thought Fujinami was far superior in the ring than Choshu or any of those other guys, to tell you the truth. I mean, there may have been some later, but I just thought he was better. It wasn't that he got overlooked. It was just that Inoki was keeping himself up there for however many years, and in Fujinami, this might have been his last shot in his mind.
Well, I'll say this, you know, I'm a huge Fujinami guy. In fact, I voted number two on my list, on the greatest wrestler ever list. He was my highest rated Japanese guy. I mean, the guy went from being awesome junior heavyweight to being awesome heavyweight, and some of the best matches of the decade against a wide variety of guys, and working different styles of matches. And he was just amazing. And yeah, he totally was probably the best guy in New Japan, no doubt, in that decade overall.
Well, so then I'm not arguing with you. I like that. That's why I always like you, Chris.
Oh, thank you. Now, Dick Murdoch, he had jumped from All Japan to New Japan in 81, and now he's upset. But to me, you know, I've watched Murdoch in both places. Murdoch always fit in better with New Japan. Wouldn't you agree, Bix?
Yes and no, because I think he could have fit in better both places. I mean, you think about the guys who were in All Japan, though, like your Hansons and your DiBiases, and he fits in pretty well with those guys.
Yeah, but where All Japan's about to go...
Yes.
I don't... You know, in 87, because the shift's about to go more towards the Tenryu Jumbo style, you know, of that type of work, I don't know if Murdoch would have hung with that. I don't know.
Dick Murdoch, the tag team wrestler, was better suited for New Japan. Dick Murdoch, the singles wrestler, for all the way All Japan was in the 80s, I think would have fit better in All Japan than he did in New Japan as a singles.
Maybe. Yeah, I can hear that. I can hear that. So, yeah, I mean, it would be interesting, of course, like I said, reporting it. Yeah, the week after Murdoch was back in Crockett and firmly in New Japan, and that's where he stayed for the next couple of years before going off to FMW later on 89. Right. Now,
by the way,
yes,
it's a fascinating period for New Japan, isn't it? Because
oh God, and All Japan too, in different ways.
Well, in every way, but New Japan, especially on the business end, because this came up on Dave Meltzer's Twitter. I want to say like a day or two before we recorded this, that someone asked him, like, "Have you ever seen any promotion before like how WWE is now, where the TV ratings are doing such a nosedive, but they're still doing such strong business?" And he said, '80s New Japan. Which, yeah. And especially this time period would be the one, because they came dangerously close to losing their TV in 87, like a couple months after this. Because I believe it was that to the TV audience at large, the UWF guys didn't really click.
No. No, they didn't.
Especially
and,
the style.
Yeah. And you know, Choshu being able to wrestle on television again saved it. You know, whenever they got that cleared up. Yeah, that's an interesting point there.
But they have such a good roster at this point. I mean, especially like the guys they have mixing, especially like the young, it's such a good mix between the UWF guys and the younger guys that are starting to come up. Like we're talking about Koshinaka starting to get a bigger push earlier. I mean, all the stuff I've seen from this period, I really like a lot.
And then you throw in Choshu and his boys all coming back in one shot.
Yeah. It feels like a very hot promotion.
Oh, yeah. You watch those Hot Summer Night shows at Sumo Hall from August 87. And I mean, it's two of the best wrestling shows I've ever seen. So, yeah.
And these are some of the hottest Japanese crowds you'll ever see, too.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And speaking of hot crowds, let's go to All Japan Women. And this is the... We're getting close to the end of the Joshi, you know, their golden age in this time period.
The Crush Girls era.
Yeah. On April 27th in Osaka, All Japan Women ran a show in front of 5,000 fans, strong house. We had two title changes. We had the Red Typhoons, Kazue Nagahori and Yumi Ogura going over Yumiko Hana and Kisako Uno for the WWWA tag titles. And the main event was Chigusa Nagayo over Leilani Kai to win the WWWA All-Pacific title.
Now, wait a second. Is this that tag match, or is this a different match in the feud?
I think this is that tag match.
Oh, I'm surprised that this was not in the Observer yet, then. I'll explain it then, I guess.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is the match where Isako Uno, later better known as Akira Hokuto, broke her neck, taking a second rope tombstone pile driver, and wrestled the rest of the match, holding her head in place for the whole match. And it also happens to be an incredible match. I mean, honestly, aside from the really iconic matches, I think I like your almost like secondary, less pushed All Japan Women talent during that era.
All right, this is on YouTube, folks. Watch.
And that is the date, April 27th?
Yes, it's Tombstone Piledriver from Second Rope. That's the title of it.
And it makes all like Benoit's Second Rope Tombstone Piledrivers look like nothing.
It's insane.
Both how she landed wrong and also just the way they were trying to do it. And this is a great match. Also, Nagahori and Ogura, though, both individually and as a tag team, are probably the most underrated workers of that All Japan Women 80s boom period.
I agree. You never hear them talk about.
Ever. And they were both fantastic. Wasn't that weren't the Red Typhoons also called the New Yorkers sometimes?
I think so. I think that they had that.
But that is a great match. That's definitely one to seek out. But anything with Nagahori and Ogura, they were just... They're really good. Like, when do they start and when do they retire? Because each tier...
I have no idea when they retired. They would have started probably in the earlier 80s.
But I just remember when I got a bunch of stuff from this period. I mean, with that New Japan stuff that we were talking about, too. Actually, it was Dave Meltzer's old Japanese tape.
Yeah, the DM tapes. Yeah.
That we both used to get copies of from a certain tape trader. This is it's just incredible stuff, and I would just pop those in like if I just wanted to watch something that I hadn't seen before, and I just pretty much watched the whole thing all the way through the whole 4 hours.
Now, this time period, you know, All Japan Women. Pete, were you like watching the female scene in Japan, or were you not into that?
Well, what I saw was great, but this is where I was. In the middle of my master's degree for college and stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't have as much time. And I also was up in Tallahassee, Florida, which is kind of a barren wasteland. And, they had, give you an idea, and this is my little Met fan tie-in for my buddy Brian there. When the Mets were in the World Series, 1986, actually the playoffs, you couldn't get TV in Tallahassee without having cable, but the local ABC affiliate, I believe it might have been NBC, but I'm 99% sure it was ABC, showed the exact same college football game that wasn't Florida State as local, instead of showing the same game that was on TBS, instead of showing the Met playoff game against the Astros. And that was the game that they won the thing in, I think, the sixth game. And I remember I went to a sports bar and watched the beginning and the end, but it's kind of a barren wasteland. And so, you know, that's why I didn't have much chance to watch that stuff. I was getting tapes from Norman Dooley and, you know, seeing a bunch of different things. You know, it was not just Memphis. It was also the other territories and whatnot, but not so much on the Japan stuff. I mean, I'd see some unbelievable stuff from the girls, like you said, the crushed cows and all that, but I wasn't, you know, watching it regularly.
Yeah. Now, did All Japan women still have their American TV at this time, or that ended?
I don't know on that one.
Because that aired on Tempo, which also aired Power Pro Wrestling and ICW and Texas All-Star and all that. It might have been done by then.
Yeah, I don't know specifics of that one.
Now, also, I mean, we should also point out, because we kind of downplayed in what we were just talking about, this is a gigantic moment in Hokuto's career. I mean, this is the beginning of the end of Sako Uno as a wrestler.
Yeah.
As a character, I guess. And then...
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. Did she come back immediately? When she came back, was it she immediately Hokuto, or she was Uno a little bit and then became Hokuto?
I'm not sure on that one either.
I might be wrong, but I'm thinking she came back as Hokuto from the beginning, from when she came back?
I'm blurry on that one. I have to search on websites on that
one. She came back... She was gone for almost 2 years, right? She came back in 89, didn't she?
Yeah, so it would make sense to go with a different character since she's been gone for so long.
Right.
So, yeah. And then, of course, she was reborn after that. And
Dangerous Queen.
Yep, became a huge star. All right, let's go to the United Kingdom. Mark Rocco, of course, who people will know more as the Black Tiger, the original, beat Fuji Yamada, who people would know more as the future Jushin Thunder Liger, on April 27th in Catford, England, on an all-star wrestling show to win the world mid-heavyweight title. Now, Bix, how much Yamada have you seen from his run in England?
I've seen a good bit. Now, do you know if this was a TV taping? Because they have some matches that were on TV.
Yes, this was a TV taping. It aired, I think, in the summer. I can't remember exactly when.
Okay.
But it was TV.
They had some tremendous matches together. I mean, he fit in there really, really well. A lot of the Japanese guys did. Some more than others. You know, Sayama did especially well. Yamada did especially well. Maeda did okay. He didn't do great, but he got a bigger push, I think, because they portrayed him as one of Sayama's relatives, because, you know, Sammy Lee and Quick Kick Lee.
Quick Kick Lee, yep.
But Yamada was here for a while, and... Maybe it was that Dynamite Kid influence that just between just, I guess, some of the more traditional style guys, but him and Rocco together, those two guys were made for each other during this era.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, Mark Rocco, like I said, was known as Black Tiger, and Pete, Tiger Mask and Black Tiger, you know, everybody talks about the Tiger Mask Dynamite Kid matches, but the Tiger Mask Black Tiger matches were just as good, if not better, than those matches were.
Yeah, that stuff, words groundbreaking does begin to describe it. You have to, you know, I guess the best way to do it is maybe not plug in the network or anything. So watch it on YouTube. But
You won't be on the network, I don't think.
Yeah, but what you might want to do is watch one of those old Madison Square Garden cards. And then watch one of the ones where Sayama appears and just look at the difference between the matches. And, you know, it's beyond groundbreaking, especially for the U.S. And these guys were the big ones, you know, between him and like you said, Rocco. And then, of course, Benoit, which are, most people know about him. But I think Sayama... Over time, unless you're a Japanese wrestling fan, American fans won't know much about him. And Rocco, obviously, the same.
Yeah, and of course, it's the Cobra match. It's on Best of WWF Volume 1 from Massacre Garden, Cobra and Black Tiger, which, you know, probably been seen by many people because that there's not that many people probably watched that tape.
And I think it aired on All American Wrestling, too.
Yeah.
And... Now, by the way, for all the credit that Dynamite gets, as far as the British guys doing like that harder, faster style goes, that's really Mark Rocco and to an extent Marty Jones before Dynamite.
Yes, Dynamite took it to the next level because he worked more places. But yeah, those two were innovators as well.
They don't get enough credit for it.
Don't get enough credit for it, sadly. Especially Marty Jones, who's a tremendous wrestler.
And by the way,
yes,
there is a ton of World of Sport on YouTube.
A ton.
And anyone who is not watching it, who hasn't seen it before, I mean, I've seen a lot of it, so I don't necessarily watch as much of it as maybe people who are discovering it, but look that stuff up. I mean, well, Mark Rocco is one of the easier wrestlers to discover in the internet era.
Watch it while you can, because WWE is trying to buy that library. So,
I mean, good luck with that for them, because, I mean, we've heard the stories.
Yeah.
ITV and Grenada and whoever owns it, they wouldn't even want to lease stuff to WWE. They would. They've asked for a lot. I mean, if WWE can get it, that's good. I mean, you know what? WWE might not get it pulled, though. They're not strict about getting stuff pulled unless it's current or from pay-per-views or whatever.
Yeah.
So, fingers crossed. But, yeah, I guess get it while you last. And also, actually, you know what? One other person I would say, Chick Cullen, too, was someone who worked that style. And because I just noticed that, too, because I just looked up to see what Mark Rocco stuff's on YouTube. And Marty... You know, and besides Marty Jones,
there's so many other guys.
Mark Rocco versus Chick Cullen was one of the ones that showed up.
Yeah, the guys. Everybody need to check it out. Anyway, on that note, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to go to the South and talk some Continental. And some big things going on there as they are switching allegiances. We'll be back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and placetobenation.com. You can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickerstaff, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO PTBN Podcast Network.
And we're back, and as usual, whenever we come back from the commercial, we always plug our Amazon.com referral link, which of course is tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon, where whenever you make any purchases from Amazon.com, go to that link first, put your items in the cart, and go from there, and as you would normally buy things on there. And of course, no money extra comes out of your account. We just get a percentage of what you buy. And it goes to our research material for stuff for this show, which of course we've gotten a little bit lately and hoping to get more to fill in some gaps where we can do more shows like this from the 80s because we are lacking in a lot of areas in the 80s and other newsletters. So, yeah, just keep on supporting us while you can. If you want to go to, through PayPal, you know, Bix, how we doing on PayPal again?
Just send it to my PayPal where you can just go to paypal.me/DavidBix and just say it's for Between the Sheets stuff and it'll
there you go. There you go.
Go to and one quick place.
And one quick thing real quick. Our buddy Chad Campbell from Where the Big Boys Play on the Place to Be Nation Network sent me a message last night. Real late. He plays in a band and plays in he played at some bar last night in I forget which town it was in Georgia. But he was wearing his Japanese Cactus Jack shirt. And I think it was one of the security guys came up to him and said, hey, I like your shirt. And he's like, yeah. He's like, have you ever heard of that podcast called Between the Sheets?
Are you serious?
I'm serious. And it blew Chad away. He's like, yeah, I know them well. You know, I have a podcast on that network as well, blah, blah, blah. So he thought that was hilarious and insane. And I think was from California too or something. Let me see if I can find the message real quick. But he was from California, so we're getting out there, Bix.
Wow, California.
I know, but still that somebody could wear a wrestling shirt.
And the first thing someone says to them is, hey, do you listen to that podcast Between the Sheets?
He is a SoCal guy, he says, so you got reach in the West Coast. Have you ever heard of a podcast called Between the Sheets? That's amazing. So, hey, all you just listening, tell friends. Let's get more listeners. Let's build it up. Maybe we can make that top 10 what culture list that they just put out last week, their top 10 podcast or something like that. Maybe we'll make one of them lists. Well, who knows? Anyway, let's get back to the show. Continental Championship Wrestling, and this is a subject near and dear to my heart because we discussed this on the last episode of Exile on Bad Street, and the next one we'll be recording soon. And, yeah, a lot of stuff going on here. Batwell Auditorium. Now, this is the show that was right before the Crockett show. The Crockett show that drew 800 people, and this one drew a double that. And this is the lineup they had. Scott Armstrong over Tom Pritchard. The Nightmares over the Shoguns, who are some local guys. Alabama Heavyweight title, Mr. Wrestling 2 over Mike Golden. Loserly Town match for the Southeastern title, Dutch Mantel over Adrian Street. No DQ match for the Continental title, Buddy Landell beating Wendell Cooley for the belt. And Texas Tornado match for Southeastern tag titles, Fuller and Golden over Tony Anthony and Jerry Stubbs in another title change. So three title changes. Conveniently days before the Crockett show. So my question to you, Bix, is we ran down the Crockett lineup earlier, ran down this lineup. What's the better show?
Let me look at the Crockett lineup again. Let's see. So Ivan Koloff, Mike Jackson, Vladimir Petrov, Bill Tabb, Bullet Bob and Rock and Rolls against Raven, Rage and Ravish and Paul Jones. The team of Ole Anderson and Tim Horner against Arn Anderson, Lex Luger, Brad Armstrong against Barbarian, Nikita Koloff and Tully Blanchard and Dusty Flair. I mean, they're both good cards on paper. I feel like, though, I'm going to lean towards Continental, though, if just for the... because I really like that main event on paper, as well as Dutch versus Adrian Street and Scott Armstrong versus Tom Pritchard.
And the thing is, Pete, you know, you look at the – is it like loyalty to the hometown promotion that comes into play here where we're going to support them and not go to the show that the major wrestling promotion is bringing to town, which that happened a lot in this era, especially when WWF was going into towns. So you think that may have played a role into it as well?
Yeah, and, you know, I hate to say it, but we're both from it for the most part. I mean, I do have New York roots, but whatever. But most people don't think think of me that way. You know, the deeper in the South, the more loyal the people were with this stuff, it really seemed. And yeah, I definitely think that. And this is a huge show when you think about it for Continental having four title matches, including Loser Leave Town match as well. So, you know, that's a huge show for them. And for Crockett's people, it's a show. It's I don't think it was that huge. And I think they're getting the loyalty still there. They're not bringing in Crockett's guys and telling them that they're better. And now we got another show with our guys, like a lot of the other territories we're doing.
Yeah, now they're in competition.
Running separate from them. Yeah, exactly. I think that makes a difference.
Yeah. Now, Knoxville, May 1st, had a lot of the same stuff going on, but they're the main event here, and Bo James will tell us about this. Wendell Cooley over Buddy Landell in 59 minutes. Big.
So given the shape that Buddy was in at this point, I'm going to assume that this was a no-knee-pads Buddy match all the way for 59 minutes.
From what I read from the report, that the first 30 was pretty much all mat work.
I thought you were going to say stalling.
Well, I'm sure that was probably part of it, too. But the first half of the match, pretty much all mat work, and then they started really kicking it up like 15, 20 minutes in.
If this is like 85, 86, I'd be thinking of this as, wow, this sounds like a great match. Seeing it in 87, I'm just thinking, wow, that sounds hilarious.
It sounds like must-see. I mean, no matter what.
Either way, yes.
Oh, man, what a match. What a show. All right. As I was alluding to before the break, allegiances have changed. After not being able to get dates on Ric Flair anymore, Continental has turned its attention to the AWA and their world champion, Nick Bockwinkle, as the world champion in their eyes. And he will be coming in soon for shots. Well, he came in. Problem was, he wasn't an AWA champion, although we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, this was Continental, Portland. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Portland, Central States, all these groups that kind of felt disenfranchised by Crockett now are trying to get lined up with the AWA. And, Pete, I mean, do you think that's like hitching your wagon to the wrong horse? And what do you think about that? You know, why we're trying to get with going to business with Vern Gagne?
Well, I think it goes back to what we were talking about before. You're keeping yourself, I don't want to say pure, but you're keeping away from becoming the minor league where they're going to, you know, because that's what Crockett was doing. He was bringing in his guys for the big shows and making your guys look like Mickey Mouse. Whereas if you go to AWA in this situation, you're just going to bring in the champion. You're not going to bring in a lot of guys, and you're just bringing in the champion like you traditionally did, which, you know, same as bringing in the NWA champion, I guess. So you're keeping tradition alive. And like we said, tradition in the South, man, it still worked much later than anywhere else. So that's my take on it is, you know, they're keeping the same thing they were doing and trying not to look Mickey Mouse or minor league.
Yeah. And Bockwinkle came in and just wasn't a champion. So, yeah, interesting stuff there.
You know, I'll add one thing though. It's also,
yes.
I wouldn't even think of it as going to business with Vern Gagne as much as what else are you going to do if you need a world champion other than try to get Bockwinkle, regardless of whether it's the AWA or not? I mean, the AWA is the other world title. It's the only other one you can really get at this point. But I have to look at it as almost more that it's Bockwinkle than it's the AWA.
Yes. Bockwinkle's about to be retired because his last match is in July. So this is like his last run, too.
There's history with this, too, when you think about it, because Memphis did it. Yeah, it's exactly what Memphis did.
So did
you know,
Hart?
Forget it. Yeah, and you went with, but you're going with, the only reason I'm bringing up Memphis is Memphis is so closely located to where Continental is, and then a lot of the same guys worked those territories and saw that happening, where, you know, they bring Bockwinkle in and they switch to the NWA or the AWA, whatever it is, but they did the same thing, and Bockwinkle worked a lot there, and that was one of Lawler's greatest matches as well. remember.
And they would recognize him as champion when he wasn't even champion.
Yep.
And that's a great segue because let's go to Memphis. And this is the story of the week. Mid-South Coliseum, April 27th, 1987, 9,500 fans, hair versus hair, loser leave town steel cage match for the Southern Heavyweight title. Austin Idol over Jerry the King Lawler, where if Idol lost, he would have to give the fans their money back. And they also announced on the April 25th television show that the hair cutting, if it happened, or the hair cutting, no matter what, whoever got their head shaved, would never air on local television. Now, before we get to that match, let's go over the rest of the show. The Hunter and Bambi over Alan Martin and Emily Arthur.
Sheets favorite, the Hunter Dale Veezy.
Yeah, and not Emily Arf Bix of Playboy fame. International
and Vince McMahon steroid trial fan.
And Vince McMahon steroid trial. International tag title, Steve Kern and Mark Starr over the Mercenaries.
Who were the Mercenaries anyway?
They were only in for like a couple of weeks.
No, but do you know who were under the mask?
I can't remember. They were not notable guys. John Paul and JT Southern over Mr. Hilo and Mr. Shima. Bix, who was Mr. Hilo and Mr. Shima?
Hiromichi Fuyuki and
Akio Sato.
I thought Akio Sato used the name Akio Sato in Memphis.
He did. He used both.
So wait, was he Hilo or Shima?
He was Shima.
And Hilo was Fuyuki.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why I always get confused because he was both Mr. Shima and Akio Sato.
Yeah, he's Goto with Goto and Sato, and then he was Shima here. And not Shima from Toriumon. Southern tag title match.
No, he's a better worker.
Oh. Southern tag title match, and Bix, this is one of your favorite teams. Chick Donovan and Jack Hart, of course, Barry Horowitz, over Rocky Johnson and Soul Train Jones to win the titles. And, of course, Soul Train Jones will become Virgil, Vincent, Mike Jones, the King of Fuck Money. No DQ match, Paul Diamond over Billy Travis. Steel cage match, Jeff Jarrett over Pat Tanaka. And they kept the cage up for the main event. Now, of course, Tommy Rich was up under the cage the whole show, up under the ring for the whole show, and he made his entrance at the end. And Bix, I mean, this is one of the all-timers. You know, this is one of the best angles matches ever in Memphis history. There's a video on YouTube, a two-hour video chronicling the whole feud, and it's just... it's gold.
Yeah, and now, by the way, is it that two-hour video?
It's a two-hour.
No, because I think it might be another video. I'm trying to remember. Which does that one have the build-up from the previous Saturday show?
I don't know. I didn't watch it. I just know it's on there.
Okay, because that's something that not a lot of people have seen, because that was only on the Memphis show. That was not on the one-hour show.
Yeah.
Because obviously they're only building up that match for Memphis because it's a hair match. And I think it is in that video, though. That's something that people need to see, because a lot of great promos in that. And then the match, of the Austin Idol matches we have, this is easily the best.
Yes.
And for all the people make fun of him with stalling and whatever, here this match is so much better for all of his stalling.
Yes. And Idol, he was awesome in this whole era, I thought.
This whole program, yeah.
I mean, Pete, when you say that this is like the peak of Austin Idol as a performer is in this program.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and Georgia. You know,
Georgia. Can't discount that. Yes.
Yeah. He was amazing, and, and Lawler was a great opponent for him because you kind of had that dynamic where, you know, this is... you know, Lawler was a great heel. Let's, you know, face it. But when you have Idol as a heel and Lawler's a babyface and Lawler's bumping all around and Idol, not that he's just standing there, but he was moving a lot better than he did later. So, you know, it kind of works.
And then you throw Tommy Rich in and it adds a whole nother element, because Tommy Rich was basically insane at this time period. And a very young Paul Danger Lee, as he was known as this time, because he had just left Florida right when Crockett bought out Florida, he left after that and went to Memphis. So Paul Dangerly, as a manager, is maybe in his second or third month in the business at this time period. And it's just an amazing segment, amazing aftermath, you know, where they're cutting their hair in the ring and fans are trying to get in the cage. Like I said, if you haven't seen it, you need to search it out. But we do want to play for you the post-match in the locker room. Lance Russell, who, of course, is God, and he walks in on Idol Rich and Dangerly celebrating. And this is just classic stuff. Play it for us, Bix.
And also, I do want to point out that they had just run for their lives through the crowd.
Yes.
The crowd was trying to storm the aisle and get at them, and they had to sprint, surrounded by cops, from the ring to the locker room.
Yes.
So. Never forget that.
And also the noise the crowd makes as they're running up the aisle, and everyone thinks that someone in the crowd is going to get at them.
Yeah.
Like, I've never heard, like, a reaction like that to anything else I've ever seen in wrestling.
Yeah.
To, like, that the crowd is, like, gasping, excited at the idea that a fan is going to probably kill them.
Yeah.
So, this is presumably right after that.
Well, a jobber reporting calls for us to come to the dressing room of Austin Idol and Tommy Rich. Officially in a history-making match tonight, Jerry the King Lawler lost his hair to Austin Idol. It should read to Austin Idol and Tommy Rich. Yeah, how do I like it? You ask it. I want to tell you what I think. I've seen a lot of wrestling. I've seen a lot of things done. That's the lowest thing I've ever seen done in my life. This guy, you've been planning this. You took care of everything. How did you end up getting in the ring? Yeah. What were you doing inside that cage?
Lance Russell, excuse us.
Yeah,
you come in to talk, but we don't need you in here. You know, I told you, Jerry Lawler, it was going to get intense. Real, real intense. I'm hungry, boy. Paulie, businessman. Look at that hair. But what we're talking about, Jerry Lawler, it everything was your way. Austin Idol put to return all the money to the building, put his hair on the line. But the one thing you overlooked, you put a big 16, 20-foot cage, but you forgot to look under the ring. Or you forgot to look when Pat Tanaka got out of the cage. They don't know where I came from. Intense, Lawler. Now you're ashamed to show your face. He don't even show his face around me. What is that?
Don't they realize something, T.R.? Don't they realize, Paulie, that I was born in Las Vegas, Nevada, Jack? I grew up not on a baby bottle. I grew up spinning the roulette wheel. I grew up playing five-card stud. I grew up pulling slot handles. I'm a gambler from the day I was born, and I'll gamble to the day I die. And, Lawler, when I put my 50,000 bucks in the bank, I put it right in the bank. There was no shucking, no jiving anymore than that. 50 grand of my money, brother. You said it came from a plane crash. It came from blood, from sweat, from tears. But you remember one thing. In Las Vegas, they always got a hole card. Hello, hole card.
Ace in the hole, baby.
You're my ace, Marlo. You're my ace. My ace.
I love it. I love it. I love it.
The greatest of all time. The new kings. Rich, sexy, and mean, darling.
King of the fools, Jerry Lawler. The people of Memphis. And you too, Lance Russell.
Let me tell you. You had the ace up your sleeve. You didn't do it fair. That's all. Okay. Let's finish it, Rich. That's enough.
How maniacal does Tommy Rich sound in that promo?
And he looks it, too, with those dyed eyebrows.
I know.
You know, don't forget he was sitting under the ring and he's drinking and he's doing whatever else all day.
God. I don't know what else he was doing under that ring. Oh, my God.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that yet. No, no.
Ooh.
Well, at least he had plenty of time to soak himself.
But, yeah, Tommy, yeah, that's just classic stuff. And, again,
by the way, I had almost forgotten that part of the buildup in the previous 2 days, as Idol mentions here, was that he had the cash to refund the fans' money because of his plane crash settlement.
Yes. Well, that and real estate. Because I'm pretty sure Idol's probably business back then.
Yeah, Memphis putting the reality in, you know, and the hair match is really gigantic. And You guys know the whole thing with Dundee. Yeah, Lawler never had lost one, and even when Dundee's wife's hair, I'll never forget that. You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, he had never lost one in all those years. And they were thinking they were getting that money thrown to them, you know, big chance of it. They were either going to see that or going to see Lawler lose. They didn't think that was going to happen. That was great. Yeah, great promotion.
Classic stuff. Well, now Lawler has to, he takes time off, you know, because he's not going to be around bald. So they got to bring somebody back to.
Well, they didn't shave him bald, though.
Well, no, he didn't shave him bald, but he had to be away for a while to sell everything.
Yes, and they gave him kind of a Bruce Willis haircut, which kind of did not get over the stipulation well.
Yeah, and they had to have a babyface come back in, and who better else to bring in than superstar Bill Dundee? And he comes back. He's going to his first show. The work is going to be on the May 4th Mid-South Coliseum show. But he showed up on TV on that Saturday, saved Randy Hales from beating by Chick Donovan and Jack Hart. And he's teaming with Bam Bam Bigelow to face Island Rich and surprise a lot of people. Since they've been announced in the previous week of Continental's television that Dundee and the Mod Squad was coming in. And also the talk was that he was going to come in to get a new book or the promotion. And Dundee felt like that going back to Memphis would be better for him. And then the Mod Squad didn't show up because of that. So they had to create a team called the Mad Squad. Which, listen to episode 2 of the Exile on Bad Street, and you'll hear Bo James talk about that.
Second episode of Continental, not episode 2 in general.
Yeah, second episode of Continental. But interesting thing here, though. There was bad blood between this promotion and Dundee because he was an important part of the show that Crockett ran in Memphis in March. For the true king of the ring in Memphis, where Dundee lost the Dusty Rhodes. And Dundee had cut promos in the market, just killing Lawler. So, funny how everything works out, doesn't it? But, I mean, Dundee coming back here, though, was, you know, it felt right. You know, he was at his best always in Memphis anyway, Bix. And this, of course, would lead to George Barnes coming back in. And this was a fun little period for Memphis. Some of the stuff wasn't that great, but still, I mean, there was a lot of fun stuff going on here with Dundee back.
Yeah, I mean, Idle and Rich are gone pretty quickly. So is Paul E. after this, unfortunately. But not really surprising, given everyone involved. Kind of amazing that we got almost six months out of it. Well,
Dundee's
6 months,
book,
including the Tommy Rich part.
And Dundee's, I think, took over the book at this time period, and yeah, I mean, it was interesting stuff. And Dundee's back as a babyface in Memphis, really. I mean, for an extended amount of time. He came back in 85, but that didn't last. But he's really back his first time as a true babyface in Memphis since 83. So,
yeah.
And team with Lawler again, because Lawler comes back and they face Island Rich until, you know, Island Rich leave. And then, you know, they become AWA Tag Champions later in the year. So, it was good for Dundee to get back here. Now, on that May 2nd television show, we had a handicap match for the international tag titles that was just won by Steve Kern and Mark Starr as Bad Company, Paul Diamond and Pat Tanaka, defeated Mark Starr to win the titles because Steve Kern was quote-unquote injured in Tampa and couldn't appear.
In other words, well, he gave his notice.
He went to work for Crockett. So, interesting how that worked out, isn't it? I tell you.
Yeah, and by the way, I'd make the argument that Bad Company in Memphis was better than they were later in the AWA.
Well, they had more matches on television that we saw, basically.
And they had better opponents. They had Jared and Travis.
And they had better opponents as well. I mean, Bad Company, in my opinion, is one of the all-time great, you know, tag teams that could have been. I mean, we had some good stuff from them, but Paul Diamond and Pat Tanaka were just awesome together. What are your thoughts on Bad Company?
Yeah, I agree with you. And obviously, that was the best thing for Diamond, I mean, ever. And Pat Tanaka was fantastic. You'd see him in the dressing room. And believe it or not, he's just smoking one cigarette after another, taking drags of it or whatever. And a dude had that he had stamina and he could work like nobody. You know, they were great. I agree with you.
Yep. It's a shame we didn't get a better run from them. Although they did, you know, they had decent matches at Orient Express and WWF, but Paul Diamond, Pat Tanaka.
Here they looked like they were about to take over the world.
Oh, yeah. This is around the same time as New Breed, too. So you had New Breed and Bad Company. Mm-hmm. It's like your young heel tag teams that look like they're about to destroy the business in a good way.
And, I mean, they would have, in their matches with Jarrett and Travis, they would have contests to see who could take the highest back body drop.
I know.
Yep.
And we talked about the AWA a couple minutes ago, so let's go there. And they had a big show on May the 2nd at the Cow Palace in San Francisco, Super Clash 2, which drew 2,800 fans, which is half of what they were expecting. But Dave Meltzer said he enjoyed this show, one of the recent Crockett shows, which says a lot about the atmosphere, since 5 out of 7 matches that happened on this show were terrible. Which he basically said the fans were more into what was going on this show than were on the Crockett show. Woohoo. Crockett drew like double the size of this one. So it says a lot for, you can put on a great show, but if you don't have the heat, what does it mean? Well, let's look at this lineup. Sheik Adonel Casey over Rock and Roll Buck Zumhoff in 1045, -1 star. DJ Peterson fought the Super Ninja Shinji Takano to a 15-minute draw, 1 star. AWA ladies title, Sherry Martel defeated Medusa Michelli to retain her title 11 minutes. Dud. AWA World Heavyweight title, yep, they put it in the middle of the show. Kurt Hennig over Nick Bockwinkel to win the title, 26 minutes, 3.5 stars. We'll talk about that match in a second. The Midnight Rockers and Ray the Crippler Stevens, that's an interesting team, defeated Kevin Kelly, Doug Summers, and Buddy Wolf, subbing for Buddy Rose in 16 minutes in a 2.75-star match. Crusher Blackwell over Boris Zukov in 10 minutes, -2 stars. And Russ Francis and Jimmy Snuka over the Mercenary, played by Brian Knobbs, and the Terrorist, played by Soldat Yusinov, in 12 minutes, 0.5 star.
Wow, you look at that lineup, and that crowd must have been really hot then if Dave enjoyed the show.
I know, and the deal with Buddy Rose was Buddy Rose had went to work for an outlaw organization in Colorado while he was working at AWA, and Vern was firing all those guys. Buddy Rose, Colonel DeBeers. I think the only two guys that didn't get fired were Leon White and Jerry Blackwell.
You mean that worked the outlaw show?
They were the outlaw show, yeah. Hennig about Winkle. I mean, this is the famous match. Hennig finally wins the title.
Sort of.
Larry Zbysko hands him the coins that he knocks out Bockwinkel with, and they stripped him of the title after the match, and they held it up because they wanted to view the finish, you know, the Stanley Blackburn, Wally Carbo, that whole deal there. AWA would do this shit all the time. But there was a reason they did this. As the story of the show was, what was being talked about behind the scenes. As Dave Meltzer said, that there were rumblings that Kurt Hennig was considering a huge offer from the WWF, and the AWA shot this big angle that may backfire on them. But with them not giving Hennig the title and having it suspended, they could always give back the Bockwinkel, saying that Hennig cheated. Dave went on to say that Hennig backed out of a verbal agreement with WWF days later, and they were very upset about this because he did the same thing late last year. Yeah, I mean, Hennig had a verbal deal with WWF, and the AWA gave him the title.
I thought that it was that they were going to do their usual dusty finish type thing and then said, oh, the videotape show did not show conclusively that Zbysko helped him, so they upheld it, but that was not the original plan.
It was not the original plan because Bockwinkel, I mean, what they had done was they had heard that he was going to WWF. So... And it was, I guess, as a way to close the program down, but have Hennig win, which is stupid.
But then get suspended because he cheated.
But it was a verbal agreement, so maybe they thought that he was going to just, you know, do what he eventually did anyway, and not go. So it worked out in the end for them, because imagine if they had decided, well, let's just job him out. Botwinkle wins again. That's another win over Henning. It pretty much kills him in a lot of ways. But they did this angle and made Kurt Henning a heel character for good, and which he was awesome in this run as cool Kurt Henning. And this was one of the few things that AWA actually got right. Pete, would you say that? I mean, they were doing a lot of bad things in this era, but cool Kurt Henning was a strong character and a good champion.
I just would have given him a little different nickname, because that cool thing kind of sounded, you know, back from the 60s or 50s or something. But
cool, man.
The matches were great. And it was good to finally see him get his due, because he was, you know, they'd been building and building him, and you could see how great he was. So I was glad to see that.
He even had a good match on television against Kevin Kelly in a heel versus heel match. And this is 1987 Kevin Kelly. I mean, it's amazing how good he was in this time period. He had a match with Wahoo. He had a match with DJ Peterson that was great on television. He had a match with Mitch Snow that was a hell of a damn match on television. I mean, he was just, and of course, Lawler later on. I mean, and Kurt was just a tremendous performer in this time period. And Biggs, I always say this, and I said this on the GW podcast that they did with Dylan, that I prefer 87-88 Kurt Henning to Mr. Perfect Kurt Henning. I mean, do you agree with that?
I think so. I don't think the golf is necessarily as big as you and Dylan make it out to be, but I mean, I still think he was better overall, because he became too one note as Mr. Perfect.
Yeah.
With the theatrical bumping and
all that. Too Sammy. Well, like I said, AWA's having problems. And this show is a full indictment on that, this house show. From Salt Lake City at the Salt Palace, where they drew 260 fans.
And this had been their hottest city, like, what, 6 months to a year earlier?
Yes.
And the Salt Palace is a big – that's the big arena.
That's where the Utah Jazz played their games at. I tell you how big that place was. Yeah, that's where the Utah Jazz played. But they ran a tag team tournament on this show. And just listen to some of these matches. Paul New and DJ Peterson. Paul New, of course, was Avalanche Paul New, who would become
PN News.
PN News.
And over, Cannonball Grizzly.
And Cannonball Grizzly over Ryuma Go and the Super Ninja. Kevin Kelly and Doug Summers over Nick Botwinkle and Ray Stevens by DQ. Midnight Rockers over the Nasty Boys.
Yeah, wait a second. Let's eliminate Nick Botwinkle and Ray Stevens in the first round.
Yes. Russ Francis and Jimmy Snuck over Buddy Wolf and Larry Zbyszko.
What a
foursome
there.
Borzukov and Soldat Yusinov over New and Peterson. Russ Francis and Jimmy Snuck over Kevin Kelly and Doug Summers. And in your finals, that's where I say finals, Borzukov and Soldat Yusinov over the Midnight Rockers. The reason why Francis and Snuka weren't in the finals was they did some sort of injury gimmick with Snuka where they couldn't compete. So, obviously, somebody had – Snuka was being asked a job. He wasn't going to do it. So, 260 fans. Yikes.
Well, would you have gone?
No, probably not. But let's move on to some hotter shows involving AWA talent as we go to the Pacific Northwest. And like I said, they've hooked up with AWA right now. And AWA guys came in for a big show in Eugene, Oregon at the Lane County Fairgrounds on May the 1st. Drew 3,000 fans. Strong house. Sherry Marcello over Medusa. Mark Young, of course, who is Mark Scarpa.
The recently departed.
Recently deceased Mark Scarpa over Sputnik. George Scotland, Arnold Scotland's son. Fought Buddy Wolf to a draw. That match sounds horrific.
Also, to interrupt for a second.
Yes.
Mark Scarpa and George Scotland. Gee, I wonder what promotion they were trying to get friendly with at this point.
Well, who do you think was in, you know, had his hand in Portland always in this era? Pipes. Coco Samoa over Joey Jack. Coco Samoa fought Joey Jackson to a draw.
Who's Joey Jackson?
If you've never seen Joey Jackson, Joey Jackson's a guy who looks like, what was the analogy I used? He looks like the love child of John Tatum and Chick Donovan.
Oh my God.
Yes. His hair is luxurious, Bix. You need to see Joey Jackson's hair. Couldn't cut a promo to save his life, but you got to see his hair. It's phenomenal. Art Cruz over DJ Peterson. The Assassin, Dave Sierra and Ricky Santana, more on them later, over Kevin Kelly and Doug Summers. Jimmy Snuka and Valeria Zbyszko by DQ. AWA World Tag Titles, the Midnight Rockers retained over Mike Miller and Revolver. More on them in a minute. And the AWA Heavyweight title, Nick Botwinkle fought Curt Hennig to a 60-minute draw. So it sounds like a fun show. The next night, though, is when we had...
And also smart booking that Hennig, who is the big AWA star, but also had been a star in Portland,
yes,
is in the main event. And that Snuka is near the top of the cards, and Snuka had been a big star in Portland, although earlier than everyone else.
And Hennig was total babyface here in this match. Now, the next night at the sports arena, and they knew that they had to do something here because Saturday Night's main event was that night. And we'll talk about that later on. But they, from what I was reading in one of the newsletters, they wanted to do a show to try to keep the people from watching their television because their television was airing at the same time. Well, I think 30 minutes before they started at 11 local time against Saturday Night's main event. We start at 11:30. So they ran a big angle. They started off the TV with a tag match with Coco Samoa and Ricky Santana against R. Cruz and Mike Miller. Match ended by DQ because Rip Oliver came out and attacked Coco's bad leg with a 2x4, then directed Cruz to further destroy the leg. They hung Coco in the corner, and Oliver told Mike Miller to jump off the top rope, but he wouldn't do it. So Oliver shoved him off and did it himself. Oliver then went to do it again, but was slammed off the top rope by Mike Miller. Mike then shoved Oliver down to the mat again when he asked him what he was doing and walked off before going to Don Koss, the ring announcer, and telling him that he remembered when he had his bad knee injury 2 years earlier against Jules Strongbow and couldn't make any money while he was out, so he had some empathy for Coco and didn't want him to go through the same thing. That's great storytelling right there. And it's a really good promo, so I wish we had the audio from it. Because, I mean, Mike Miller, underrated promo guy as a heel, but he was really fun as a babyface promo. But Bix, I mean, this was a big angle for Portland because Portland had – they had gone through a down period in 86. I mean, it was bad. I watched some of that television. It was really boring. Well, this angle right here and some other things that are happening down the line – really give this territory a kick in the ass. How much Portland have you seen from this era, first off?
I don't think I've seen anything from 87.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to watch. Portland,
well, you know what?
I've
seen the stuff on Pro Wrestling this week, but that's it.
Yeah, Portland is kind of like, it's Memphis in a lot of ways, and in its bad times, it's like Memphis as well. You know, Memphis would get in sometimes some of the dead periods.
It's Memphis for hippies.
Yeah, Portland was the same way. But, yeah, this is a hot angle. But the main event of this show is a coal miner's glove match where the Assassin, Dave Sierra, defeated Matt Bourne in the best match in this building in 2 years. And I think they showed this on television. But the deal is the Assassin had turned babyface earlier in the year because he was a heel too. And the coal miner's glove deal was that Dutch Savage was the like the king of the coal miner's glove match in Pacific Northwest.
Right. It was the big – well, the two big gimmick matches or stipulation matches or whatever in the territory were coal miner's glove match and hair versus hair.
Yeah. So Dutch Savage shows up on television and gives Dave Sierra his personal – coal miner's glove.
Now, had he been on TV at all since his split from the promotion?
Yeah, he had done announcing. He announced for Don Koss when Don Koss couldn't do it. And
he had already been back since 83 or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. So he presents the coal miner's glove to the Assassin, which is a big deal. The Assassin used it to beat Matt Bourne and would keep on using it throughout his run as the Assassin and then when he came back as Top Gun in 88. But Dave Sierra, If everybody just knows him as Fidel Sierra, Cuban Assassin, all of his other assorted gimmicks, you need to watch him in Portland. He is phenomenal here. As a promo man, in the ring, he is a tremendous form. One, Mix, wouldn't you say he's one of the most underrated guys of his era?
Yeah, and for whatever reason, though, he just never really got a big push outside of Portland. And I mean, he's a Florida guy. So, well, wait, is he from Florida originally or Texas? Because I know he settled in Florida.
I think he's from Texas originally.
Because didn't he help out like in the Houston office or something at one point, or the Dallas?
Yeah,
office?
David Patterson's his real name. And he worked there. Then he worked in, let's see, he worked there and then he went to
Fox. I thought it was Dave Cannell.
That's it, Dave Cannell. Excuse me. He worked as David Patterson.
Now, did it ever turn out whether it was true that Bill Alfonso's his brother?
You know anything about that, Pete?
No, I was going to say the same thing. I never got anything definitive. I think they are related in some way, but I'm not sure if they're brothers.
Because I remember
cousin.
Hearing that Bill...
It's his cousin.
But is Bill's last name Cannell?
You know what? I'm not sure. Yeah, it's funny because Fonzie sees me. He always says hi, and you know, couldn't be happier and all that. And then, but I haven't talked to him about that, and I really should.
Well, you know what? You know the connection there, right? What's Bill Alfonso's real last name? You know the Bix?
I
was going to say I wasn't sure. I couldn't remember. I wasn't sure.
Sierra. Oh. William Matthew Sierra. That's Bill Alfonso's name.
Okay. Well, there you go.
And,
yeah, and then, you know, when he started in Florida, he wrestled as David Sierra.
And you know who Bill's stepbrother is?
Ricky Sandman.
Bob Roop.
Oh, okay.
And Dave Sierra is his cousin. So there you go.
Okay.
When did Sierra finish up in Florida?
Which run?
Well, did he go to Florida after? When was the 87 run in Florida as the Cuban Connection?
We're about to get into that.
Okay.
Because it's coming up. But he went back right after this. Like a week or two after this. So, because I think he lost Lose Leave Town and then he left. But
was
was
Santana his partner for that too, or was it someone else?
We're getting into that. Okay. You're jumping ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, you're jumping ahead. So since we're jumping ahead, let's jump to world class. And the another big story this week is the much rumored Bum Bright buyout of world class from Fritz Von Erich was finalized this week, but they were given non-answers or completely denying reports to the media. The Dallas Cowboys owner will be completely revamping the production of the television, as he will be moving the operations from Continental Syndication to Lee Martin Productions, which is owned by Bright, and he wants to move the TV tapings from the Sportatorium to a 1,000-seat TV studio-type building in Irving, Texas, near Texas Stadium before the end of the month, month of May. There has been talk that with Bright involved, there will be more money put into promotion to compete against Jim Crockett and WWF, but Dave said that they aren't looking at this logically because other than a few exceptions, every major piece of talent in the business is locked up either with JCP or WWF to long-term contracts. Dave said that Bright is coming to the business over a year too late, and even with all of his money, Bright and World Class will have to start from ground zero, as they will need not just money, but wrestling expertise to turn their promotion around again.
Now, that said, the reason that they denied it to the media was because it was not true.
Yeah. The problem with TV, though, is huge, because the people at Channel 39, which operates Continental Syndication, were extremely upset because they found out about the change in the Observer. The promotion told them it was all just rumors. Then a week or so later, they found it was true. Continental is now talking to Kim Mantell about working with him on a new promotion as early as next week, with a belief being that the station across the country that was airing World Class will start airing this new promotion instead. And that new promotion will become Wild West Wrestling, which also is interesting because Kim Mantell, even though he is gone from UWF, had a deal with Crockett at the time to maintain the UWF training center, as they were still training talent to appear on UWF television, but they were also putting guys on Wild West Wrestling, his trainees there. So Kim Mantell was working all kinds of different angles here with businesses, but the production totally changed in World Class right after this move happened.
And it was not for the better.
And not for the better either. I mean, it was a huge difference. Although I would have been interested, though, to see how it would have went if they would have actually done that move and moved it out of the Sportatorium to a different studio.
Well, they probably should have, because the, you know, when you've got the empty benches in the Sportatorium, it doesn't look good.
And it was visibly empty in this time period. And that's, again, Pete, you know, we talked about promotions that were on the downward spiral. I mean, World Class in 87 was about as bad as it got as far as downward spirals, considering what they once were.
Well, yeah, and that, from what I heard, you know, when you had all those empty benches and stuff, you could actually see the rats. And I'm not talking about the rats that were there in the Von Erichs heyday. I'm talking about the rats running down the building.
Or my favorite guy, and Rob Naylor's favorite wrestling fan ever, the guy that was, had the white shirt with USA on it, that was sitting in like the white shorts, the one that looked like a Bobo Carrier Von Erich.
Yeah.
I never noticed any rodents on camera. Really?
It didn't me either, but, you know, it just sounded good, but I always hear about that, how run down the building was.
He's making a funny there, Biggs. Why are you stopping all of his joke?
It was very deadpan then.
Exactly. So, sarcasm so isn't funny. It never should be used.
They did make a deal with Bumbright to do take over the TV, but no, he didn't. Wasn't buying the company. And I mean, they did some things well, I guess. I liked like the extra features they added to the show, like the Kerry Von Erich segment while he was injured and the Gary Hart thing or whatever they did. But no. Gary Hart was Pro Wrestling This Week, but Fritz's segment with the classic matches, whatever. Like, that was okay, but, you know, they got rid of the World Class theme song.
Yeah. And they went with this, like, introduction that had, like, this nightlife look of Dallas.
Kind of smooth jazz thing.
Yeah, which they kept some of that for their later intros. That nightlife look of Dallas.
No, they always had the Dallas – they had the Dallas skyline before that.
Not in the early intro. No, they were still doing the old world-class intros going into this time period.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It was – that's right, that they when the Continental came back in, they kept it. You're right.
Yeah, they kept it in.
But with the with the classic theme song.
With the classic music, yeah. But
I liked that Skyline intro, though.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Oh, wow, but, Kevin Federline died.
Oh, God. This is news. Oh, well. Wow. What is it?
I just saw a bunch of tweets in a row, unless it's a hoax. I don't know.
I'm not seeing anything, but oh, well. I wonder what that says about my Twitter feed.
I'm just seeing a bunch of RIP Kevin Federline. I don't know if there are any articles or anything. That's interesting.
There is that random wrestling tie-in there, too. But
yeah, there's a wrestling tie-in, too, but nobody
else. That was a really good match that he had seen. I'm not kidding.
That's too, is that too modern for you or no?
Yeah, Bix, come on. Yeah, there's nothing. I don't think there's anything to that. Why did you do this during the show?
I was shocked at the alleged death of Kayfed, but this might be a hoax. I think
I'm looking at live a thing. It's... It looks stupid. I don't know. I think, why'd you do this? Can we edit this out? Please. I mean, this is stupid.
That's the point.
Edit this out.
Why don't you just give him a call? I know you got him on speed dial.
Because he's not dead. Nobody, I mean, no major reports are.
Oh, no, it'll answer. Oh, good point.
Yeah, there's nobody talking about it other than like randoms on Twitter with no followers.
Wow. I will call him on my speed dial then, so we can.
There you go. Yeah.
One second. Let's dial. Let's call Kevin Federline and see if we can.
Yeah. I mean, I went to search people off. Somebody, Kevin Federline.
Hey, there, wrestling fans! It's Saturday, April 30th. Here.
Anyway.
Oh, my. Yeah, I don't know what that is. Somebody must have mentioned him somehow, some way. Because, I mean, the tweets I'm seeing is from like 40 minutes ago, and it's not trending at all worldwide. And people are just talking about
it. Unless everyone just forgot who he was.
It's just a bunch of rant. No, no.
Okay, I'm not editing this out, though. This is too good.
Oh.
Well, I saw two different tweets, so I was like, oh, it must be true. They were, like, right on top of each other.
It's going to make you look a moron.
I know.
Oh, well. Anyway, since you're not going to edit this out, I guess let's get back on here. Ricky Santana.
Maybe I will.
It, and David Sierra are rumored to be heading the world class.
And then went to Florida.
And then they went to Florida instead. So that would have been interesting to see
them back home.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense because the booker at this time was, let's see, Brody was still booking, but he eventually Lynn Denton took over, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I thought Gary Hart took over for Brody.
But Gary Hart took over, that's right. But Lynn Denton was here. So, Ricky Santana, of course, has tie in with Brody from Puerto Rico. And, you know, knows David Sierra, but yeah, he didn't happen. Went back to Florida, and that's when they became the Cuban Connection.
I like their matches with the Sheepherders.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. Again, Dave Sierra, man, good stuff. And Ricky Santana, another guy who was really underrated performer.
A lot of blood for TV matches.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Well, speaking about a lot.
And when he started, you know, he was Aldo Marino.
Aldo Marino, yep.
Yeah. And I saw him with Rusty Brooks and all those guys back when he started and whatnot. And
Joe Murtagh.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, all the guys that you would see working the underneath on the WWF shows in Florida.
TV tapings, too. Yep.
TV tapings. And then also would work like the IWA shows.
Mm-hmm.
The group that was running Outlaw to Florida. At a time, which that's a whole nother interesting group.
What, Rustin's IWA or a different IWA?
No, this is a different IWA.
Different one, yeah.
Just that Bugsy McGraw and Ox Baker as your main event feud.
Wow.
In 1985.
But a young Dean and Joe Malenko and Boris was there too. Right.
You had Chick Donovan and Doug Summers, which was I think your heel tag team or. No, Randy Rose and Doug Summers may have been the heel tag team. And then Vern Henderson was getting pushed. Yeah, it was interesting. All right. Let's finish off the West Coast here. Potpourri. Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer has opened up a wrestling school in Sacramento and has already started airing ads during the WWF and the UWF TV shows in the Bay Area. Now, Biggs. You guys, of course, on the 605 Super Podcast have talked about this extensively. And you guys played one promo from the internet that Buzz did, but we found another one that's exclusive to this show. So it's a little bit shorter, but it's the same type of thing. So let us hear the tones of Buzz Sawyer.
I'm a pro wrestler. I want you to call right now. 344-5588. You know, it don't get no better. It's not easy. It's hard. So when you're coming to see the Mad Dog, I want you to know when you walk in the door that you're going to be sweating and you're going to feel a lot of pain and a lot of agony, but you're going to come out a better man.
Yeah, you'll come out a better man for sure. That Buzz had just been cut. I don't know if I say cuss the right word. When Crockett took over UWF, Buzz had just come back in. And when Crockett took over, he got shown the door really quickly. As there was some bad blood there from years back. But I remember watching all this UWF shows. We did the Watts project on for DVR Bix. And a lot of the UWF shows in this era was from that Stockton, California station. And there were so many promos for this school aired during this time period. It was hilarious. There was one with Brett where they were on some porch that I remember, some house. I mean, the story that y'all had on your show was great. I guess tell everybody, you know, give like a quick Cliff Notes deal about your Buzz Sawyer wrestling school story from 605.
All right. That is episode 19 of 605 Super Podcast. And we did a Buzz Sawyer thing. We talked to Jason Rudy, who was a student at the wrestling school. We talked to another listener, Will Sweetie, who had had a run-in with Buzz at the school, and also Jim Cornette with a Buzz Sawyer story from when the Midnights worked with Buzz and Dick. Who was Buzz and Dick Slater?
It would be either him or Dick Slater, him and Brett.
I forget which, during that run in Crockett that, you know, led to the bad blood. And it's the story about how Dennis Condrey almost shot Buzz with a gun. And that's all there. So check that out there. I mean, it's interesting stuff because it's a different side of Buzz. And we don't really hear about him normally as an actual human being, I guess. So that's there. And also some stuff tying into the mysteries about his death and all that. So check that out. That's episode 19.
Now, Pete, Buzz is a Florida guy. So I'm pretty sure that you had some Buzz Sawyer stories you heard over the years. I mean, he was an interesting cat.
Well, he, watching him, you knew he was going to be great. And the guy ran the ropes and did everything with more intensity. And it almost looked like he was going 150 miles an hour, best power slam, that drop kick and all that. You know, and you saw him, like, when he started as a baby face, and the maniac heel thing really, you know, fit him the best, obviously. I only heard stories about him, like, you know, hanging by the dressing room. And I'm trying to remember who it was that these people were ripping on. I don't think it was Tommy Rich. I don't think so. I don't remember who it was, but in any case, Buzz is sitting there standing fairly close and listening and laughing, and then he excuses himself for a second, and then he goes in the back and pees in a cup of beer, a beer cup, and then comes out and throws it on the people that were making fun of the other guy. That's a story.
I mean, he's something else, and I mean, God, yeah. A guy who, if he would have stayed straight and clean, no telling how great he could have been.
Yeah.
Just one of the natural
like that.
Mm-hmm. He's just a natural talent. That it's a shame. It's a shame he died young. God.
Now, which guys was it that you heard the famous stories about him? It might have been the Sting or the Ultimate Warrior or something, but like one of the guys gave him money for the wrestling school, or maybe it wasn't those guys. I don't remember. Someone pretty.
Yeah, they were already in the business. I can't remember who it was. Mick, do you remember who it was?
I'm not sure.
Okay. And now let's go to the World Wrestling Federation, where interesting news here before we start talking about Saturday Night's Main Event is that the new president of Boston Garden has told both JCP and WWF that he wants to have one show a month from them from now on. But there's a huge problem for JCP, as they have no local TV in Boston, as WWF bought that slot out, and the closest they have is in Worcester. Oh, man. And they treated that Boston Garden show as a big deal on television, Bix, where they were promoting that show pretty heavy because, of course, Dusty is a huge Boston Celtics fan. Flair is a huge Lakers fan, so they were getting those shots in. The teams are meeting in the finals, although not this time period. The regular season was still going on. But, yeah, I mean, that was a big deal to clear Boston Garden for Crockett, though. It's one of the few big buildings in the North they could get.
Yeah, I mean, the building war was a big part of the wrestling war. And losing out on a chance like that, not great. And I'm just trying to think. I mean, think of it. Look at how long some of the other stuff took. I mean, they had access to the Meadowlands, I guess, when they wanted. Why didn't they run the Meadowlands? Well, I guess because they didn't have local TV, right?
That plays a big role in it. You know,
I feel like New York is maybe a place they could have run off of TBS, though.
Well, they ran the Garden for the first time on April the 4th. It was Dusty and Big Bubba in a steel cage match, and that was it.
That sure drew well, didn't it?
11,000 fans. And they, you know, the president wanted to run there, but never did it because he didn't have the TV. Well,
wrestling.
Speaking of television, Saturday Night's Main Event of number 11 took place on May 2nd, 1987. It was taped on April 28th, so quick turnaround. From South Bend, Indiana, the home of the Fighting Irish, Notre Dame, at the Joyous Athletic and Convocation Center. Sellout crowd of 93.45. Showed that a 9.5 rating and a 26 share.
A 26 pretty strong share nationally.
At 11:30 at night.
Well, the share takes the time. The share is the percentage of the TVs that are on.
Yeah, no, but still.
Yeah.
That's pretty damn good.
And it's the 9.5 rating that takes in, that where you got to take that into account. Yeah.
Yeah, at 11:30 at night on Saturday night.
Yeah.
So, still hot.
What was SNL doing at this point?
Not 9.5 ratings. That's why that there was Saturday Night the Main Event was more in this era.
Saturday Night the Main Event was never actually once a month, right?
No. See, SNL, this was the first year that Lorne was back in charge.
No, it's the second year. The first year with the famous cast.
First year with the cast. Well, the Dennis Miller and Phil Hartman and John Lovitz, that cast. So, yeah. So they were still trying to find their footing.
That cast found their foot. Well, ratings wise, yes.
Yeah, find their ratings footing. All right, to the show. We had Kamala over Jake the Snake Roberts. Kim Chi interfered as the referee was distracted by Fuji, hit a clothesline to the back of the head of Roberts, and after the match, Kim Chi climbed back in the ring, took off his costume to reveal himself as the Honky Tonk Man, who then dropped several elbows on Roberts before dropping him the shake, round, and roll. And Honky then took the mic and thanked the fans for their support before leaving ringside. Star and a quarter, Bix.
This is a really good angle.
I forgot to tell you to check this out. Can you find it real quick?
Give me one second. I mean,
as you do that, I'll vamp with Pete.
Well, I just need to go right to the finish. So,
yeah, Pete.
That's easy on the network. Yeah.
Honky
Tonk
Man
anyway.
Okay. Yeah, Honky Tonk Man as a character. This is when he's really starting to find himself because he came in as a babyface. That didn't work. They turned him heel. He's feuding with Jake, and he's a month away from winning the Intercontinental title. And whether he was good in the ring or not, that was an effective character in this time period.
Yeah, talk about someone that, is a real heel, right? So, because, the idea that, who's going to like this guy? It's turned into now, obviously. But that's my thing, is that he was hated and cocky and obnoxious and, really a horrible wrestler, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah.
But that made the gimmick better.
Yeah, it made the gimmick better.
Yeah.
One of the few times that you can say that about somebody, that their sorriness as a performer was actually, not a detriment.
Yep.
It was better that he looked more out of his league.
Yeah.
It got him more heat. So, all right.
Yeah,
I got it queued up.
Yeah. All right.
Take the stake. Wait a minute. Fuji's grabbing the referee. What's happening here?
Oh, Kim Chi came into the ring when Fuji had Joey Morella distracted.
Oh, no.
Kim Chi did the damage. Big splash. On a three count. Tremendous win for Kamala, the Ugandan headhunter.
Holy crowd sweetening.
Fuji was tracking the referee, and Kim Chi came in. From behind, he leveled Jake the Snake, and Kamala with that awesome splash. And you can see the net effect of the splash, some injured ribs there.
Smart move on the part of Fuji and Kim Chi, because Joey Morella is not the greatest referee. Very easy to distract that. Smart move. There you see the man, Kim Chi, who
Kim
did the damage.
Taking his hat off to Kamala. Kim Chi has led Kamala on to many a victory. Kamala now with a new manager, Mr. Fuji. But again, you can see the effect of that splash on Jake.
Wait, what a classy dresser Kim Chi is.
That's the Honky Tonk Man.
You mean to tell me all this time, Honky
That's
Tonk
the Honky Tonk
Kim Chi?
Look at that. It's a honky. Look, I can't believe he's doing that.
I love it. I mean, the guy even fooled me. Kim Chi is the Honky Tonk Man. A honky-tonk man disguised as Kenji. You know, I'll bet you he keeps Kamala in line when he plays those sweet notes on the guitar to him. Honky-tonk man can't be Kenji. Oh, no, don't do this. Let's shake Rado Rowe. Sets him up. Jake the Snake now. Oh! And they're cracking down to the canvas. Look at this. I can't believe that a honky-tonk man has done this. How low can you go?
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're a beautiful audience. Thank you. Thank you for all your support. I love you. You're a beautiful audience. Thank you.
This guy is so gracious. I mean, the honky-tonk man really appreciates a good crowd.
I think so, huh? This man's going to pay and pay dearly one of these days, no question about it. In a moment, ladies and gentlemen, we'll take you back to Pontiac, Michigan. The Pontiac Silverdome.
No. All right, next match, Randy Macho Man Savage pinned George Animal Steel in a lumberjack match in 6:44 with a flying elbow after Danny Davis, one of the lumberjacks, climbed in the ring and hit Steel from behind with a timekeeper's bell as the other lumberjacks fall on the floor. Jim Duggan was ejected from ringside around the four-minute mark and chased after chasing several other lumberjacks in and out of the ring with his 2x4. And after the match, the lumberjacks brawled in the ring until Jake Roberts appeared with his ribs taped and cleared Kim Chi from the ring with Damian. This bout was announced as the last meeting between Savage and Steel. 2¾ stars Dave gave this match, mainly for everything that was involved. But I'm
glad it was the last. Did any two wrestlers wrestle each other on Saturday Night's Main Event more than these two?
No, they dominated Saturday Night's Main
Event.
They
had, what, three different matches?
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. I mean,
go ahead.
And this was fun. This was a fun match. And they're Savage getting ready to turn babyface. That's why it's the last match.
We have a George Steele interview with Gene Okerlund.
Oh, please. Let's hear this.
Well, I don't know, Vince. I'll have to ask him. George the Animal Steele, do you understand what a lumberjack match is?
You know,
George, there's going to be 15 wrestlers surrounding that ring, and if either you or the Macho Man gets thrown out, either one or all 15 of them will throw you back in the ring until we have a decisive victor.
Right.
George, there is no escape in a lumberjack match. George, do you realize that if you lose this match, it could be the last time that you ever see the lovely Elizabeth?
Elizabeth!
Yes.
No.
Oh, this isn't right, Vince. I really don't think that George the Animal Steel understands how brutal a lumberjack match can be. Back to you.
And he's nuzzling in his shoulder. I mean, you know, you hear his promos, but it's like, what do you expect? He was a gym cheater.
Yeah. That's terrible. All right. after the match, we had the first...
Jeez, he could have sold it.
The first, television promo encounter between Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, where Andre and Heenan made the claim that Hogan really isn't the world champion.
Well, the first since WrestleMania.
First since WrestleMania. And Joey Morella again takes the brunt of the punishment.
I actually have to cue this up. So let's talk about Joey Morella for a second. I don't know.
Joey Morella, of course, is Gorilla Monsoon's son and died in a car accident. 94. That's right. And he was just the butt of all the jokes on Coliseum videos and television because he was Gorilla's son. Right. But he was one of the main referees, and they never really did anything with him angle-wise. He was just the referee, Joey Morella.
Even Gorilla would single him out more than the other referees.
Yes.
Here's the Heenan and Andre interview.
All right.
All right, we are privileged to have for the very first time since WrestleMania 3... Andre the Giant is our special guest at this time, along with his manager, Bobby the Brain Heenan. Gentlemen, now that the dust is settled from WrestleMania 3, what about that devastating loss?
What do you mean devastating loss? There was no loss in WrestleMania for us. We defeated Hulk Hogan right in the middle of that ring, fair and square.
If that's the case, Andre the Giant, how come you're not the heavyweight champion of the world?
Because I was cheated. For the Bobby and infamy... I'm not the real champion.
Oh, Bobby Heenan.
No, let me explain something to you. Please. In all of Hulk Hogan's matches, the referees are biased. They go one way and they go for Hogan. The officials always back Hogan. Jack Tunney, well, we know what his integrity
Jack
lies.
Jack Tunney?
Yes, Jack Tunney, the president. We know what he's capable of doing. Everybody's out to help Hogan. They're out to slap him on the back. Well, I have film footage to show you. I'm going to show you and the whole world. 93,000 people, wouldn't it? Over millions and millions. This is the champion of the world.
Let's take a look, Bobby Heenan, on that subject. Let's roll the footage. Here we are at the Silver Dome in Pontiac, Michigan.
Okay, now there's your champion, Hulk Hogan. He's saying everything that I can't even repeat. Try and... Yes, he's trying to get Andre upset. But no, we're not losing it. Look at Andre. He's poised. He's cool. He's falling into our trap, Hogan. Now, there's a man that's talking like a man who knows he's on his way out. A man that's going to lose the championship of the world. Look at Andre. Confident as can be, because he is the giant. He is the champion. Look at Hogan. Oh, shoved right out of the picture. That doesn't even affect the giant. A punch. One doesn't affect him. Two doesn't move him. Three doesn't even move him. Now, we set him up. We knew he'd go for the slam.
Just
up. He hooked his leg, shifted his weight. One, two, three. We've got a new champion of the world. He counted to three. You saw it. 93,000 saw it. Millions saw it.
Wait a minute. There, the referee is reinforcing his decision. He only came up with a two count.
He's lying. The man counted to three. You saw it. The people saw it again. He counted to three. I demand an investigation, and I demand an investigation now.
What are you telling me, Andre the Giant, that the referee was trying to pull something here, some chicanery, some shenanigans?
Chicanery.
I don't know what he tried to put on there, but I'll tell you one thing. I know I'm the world champion.
It's very simple. You strip him of the championship, you give the belt to this man, or you demand a rematch.
Well,
it's that simple.
Thank you very much, Bobby Heenan. Thank you, Andre the Giant. Vince, let's go back to you. I can't believe it.
Believe it.
Thank you, Mean Gene. As this crowd rises as we hear the music for the entrance of the British Bulldog.
There you go. That Joey Morella, I'm telling you. And Jack Tunney, he was on the take. Everybody knew that.
Elizabeth doing favors for him.
Oh, God. Well, I can imagine what... Imagine what she was doing. Ugh. All right. Davey Boy Smith and Dynamite Kid with Tito and Santana in their corner defeated the WWF Tag Champions, the Hart Foundation, with Jimmy Hart and Danny Davis in their corner in a best 2 out of 3 falls match, 2-0. Fall number one, they won by DQ as Neidhart, who was the illegal man, joined in double teaming Dynamite and refused to listen to referee Joey Morella's orders to leave the ring. So he got DQ'd. And then fall number two, Dynamite pinned Neidhart and 948. Titles, though, did not change hands because the first fall ended on a DQ, 2 3/4 stars.
And then when they brought the next time they had a 2 out of 3 fall tag title match on Saturday night's main event, there was a DQ in the first fall again, but it was still, that time it was a title change.
Yeah. So they had their formula booking.
Also, didn't they call this English rule? No, but it was a title change that time.
Yeah, I know, but they had their way of booking tag matches.
Oh, of doing 2 out of 3 falls matches. Yes, that it would be an EQ, and then
yeah,
and also didn't they call this something like English rules that they acted like it was a rounds match?
I don't remember if it was called that or not.
I think they did.
All right, Intercontinental title match: Ricky Steamboat defeated Hercules by DQ in 6:42 when Hercules began choking the champion with his chain. Now, prior to the match, Randy Savage was shown watching the match backstage with Miss Elizabeth and Gene Oakland, where Savage said he wanted to see Steamboat keep the belt so he could take it from him personally. Steamboat was shown cheering. Bonnie Steamboat was shown cheering Ricky Steamboat during the bout and on the inserts. Savage appeared ringside midway through the bout and grabbed Hercules' foot as Steamboat was caught in the full Nelson, causing Hercules to release the hold. After the contest, Savage went to check on Steamboat before he dropped the flying elbow on the champion, 2.5 stars. Didn't we just talk about this type of deal on the show? Was it last week?
What?
Where somebody wanted to be the guy to keep the champion?
Yeah, the Brett Hogan thing, and then trying to figure out if that had been an idea for Sting originally.
And here's Savage doing that same deal. He wanted Steamboat to stay the champion so he could win it from him. Problem was, Honky beat him to the punch.
Also, Bonnie Steamboat siding.
Yes.
Would she have still been pregnant at this point, or would she have just had Richie?
Ooh. I think that's... I don't know if Richie was born or not. Let me check and see.
This is right around when he was born.
Yeah, it's in that time. in that time frame. He's born on July 7th. Oh. So, yeah.
So
she's still pregnant.
Ready to pop.
And Pete, how did that make Ricky Steamboat come off to you when they kept showing, you know, when his wife was introduced and brought his son in, him as the family man? Do you think that was a detriment to his character, to like the male fans?
See, I was in a different place then, because I was like totally in with the business and, you know, shooting photos and stuff. But I didn't think it was the best idea, you know. But it was legit, because I could tell you, I was at a TV taping in West Palm Beach, and actually took a picture of Ricky. I guess he had the world title belt, you know, as a WCW taping.
Yeah, yeah.
And we, like, behind the bleachers and stuff like that, I have a picture of him with the world title holding Richie. kind of remind me a little of Bob Backlund in that way, that it was legit, you know, the love for the kid and that type of thing. Backlund was someone that I wanted to, this is years and years ago, but his fan club president knew me from the WFIA people, and he wanted me to meet him. And we go up to the bar, and I'm like, okay, here goes this guy's kayfabe stuff, right? And Backlund's up there with this lady, and I'd seen an article where, you know, I'd seen his wife, and this wasn't his wife. So I'm going like, okay, strike two, right? Well, no, because Backlund met this lady to take her son to the bathroom because it was in Madison Square Garden and she didn't trust him going by himself. And this is the world freaking champion, and I can't make this up. Okay?
It's so amazing.
Yeah, so going back to Steamboat here, Steamboat, I mean, it was legit, but is that what you want to, you know, it's too much of the babyface. I mean, the whole thing about, I don't know the babyface came from it, but the whole thing about kissing babies and junk like that, and I think it was a little out of touch for the time, if that makes any sense.
And that's one thing. WF wasn't really doing it yet, but I mean, they're showing her on camera. It wasn't until when he went to NWA is when they really ratcheted it up. But
yeah.
He's a guy with values. He's a family man.
Oh my God.
Only wrestler, that's not hard to understand. Ricky.
Oh,
Lord.
I've heard this in years. Oh, man.
It's still the same girl.
Oh, man. Hilarious. Oh. Well, back to Saturday Night's Main Event. The Can-Am Connection, Rick Martel and Tom Zink, defeated Nikolai Volkoff and Iron Sheik at 4:45. When Martel pinned Sheik with a roll-up as Jim Duggan, who sat ringside for the match, brawled with Volkoff inside the ring. After the bout, Duggan was knocked to the floor before he, Martel, and Zink cleared the ring of the opposition, 1.5 stars. So that's your TV main event right there. The Can-Am Connection.
Well, not really. The main event.
No, well, you know what I mean. It's the last match to air.
Your show closer.
Your show closer. But that would mean that the real main event was Savage and Steel then.
Second match. It wasn't all. Sometimes it was the first match. It wasn't always the second match.
Most of the time, it was second match. Most of the time, but anyway, they had a dark match because they had. This is what happened. They only sold 2,000 advance tickets going into the week before the show, so they had to quickly, scramble around and make a dark match to advertise on television and the newspapers that week before the show. So they decided to book Hulk Hogan and Ken Patera as a tag team against Andre the Giant and Hercules, who was subbing for Bobby Heenan when Hogan pinned Hercules. And I don't know if this match made the difference or not, but they had a 7,000-plus walk-up bump in 1 week. So that's pretty good. pretty good bump. Now, if you're wondering why Kip Patera is involved here and wondering why Bobby Heenan didn't work that match, well, earlier that day on Superstars of Wrestling, and so this is good synergy here, they had a debate between the returning Kip Patera and Bobby the Brain Heenan, hosted by Gene Oakland, which was taped on April 23rd at the Centrum in Worcester. And during the segment, Heenan attempted to attack Patera with his belt, but Patera easily fighting him off, wrapped the belt around Heenan's neck, and threw him across the ring. Heenan was then taken out on a stretcher following the incident, which resulted in Heenan wearing a neck brace for several months. And we have this debate, do we not, Vix?
Yep.
Here we go.
All right. Mr. Patera, at this juncture, I'm going to give you the opportunity to state your case. Mr. Patera, begin.
As I was sitting in prison, weasel, I had a lot of time to think of the Bobby Heenan types of this world. Types like yourself. As I needed moral support, which you granted me, you said that you were going to stand behind me 110%. Nothing was going to go wrong. As I sat in that courtroom during that 7 days of trial, you were never there. You never showed your face. Then as I was sitting in the cell, in a prison cell, not one phone call, not one letter, not one visit. You had completely abandoned me, Heenan.
When
I was
How could you,
on my
Heenan?
Luck, wondering what next. He had to have made some kind of contact, maybe with my family. So I called my wife. I talked to my children. Have you heard anything from Bobby? They said, no, not even a phone call, not a letter, nothing. You had completely abandoned me, which was completely against what you had stated earlier.
All right, I thank you. And now, Mr. Heenan, for your rebuttal. You may start.
First of all, ex-con, I want you to get something straight. And you listen up real good. I'm a businessman. I'm not a babysitter. And what you do outside the ring, big, big ex-con punk, is your business, not my business. My job is to get you booked in that ring. And as far as calling your wife and your two snot-nosed kids, I could give a damn.
All right, gentlemen. Finally, we have come to the point in the debate where we're going to give you an opportunity to summate. For your closing comments, we will begin with you, Ken Patera. You may start.
Like I stated earlier, Heenan, I'm proud to live in the United States of America. I pay my debt. That's behind me. I'm proud of my amateur record, the blood, sweat, and tears that I poured out in the gym every day to represent the United States of America in the Olympic Games. I'm also proud of my professional record. But there's one thing that I have left to do, something that's going to make me very, very proud, and that is to rid the world of the scum like you, weasel!
All right. Mr. Heenan, we're going to allow you time for your closing comments. You may begin.
You're not going to walk right up the ladder to the World Wrestling Federation top if I got to get every member of my family and make sure you're mentally, physically, and financially busted. I'll do it. All you ever concerned yourself with was pressing weights, and all you're good for now is pressing license plates. Well, I'll tell you something, pal. You never brought me a championship. You never brought me nothing. All you wanted was a title. All you wanted was a belt. You want a belt? You want a belt? I'll give you a belt.
How about Heenan? Heenan's all aggressive in this segment, isn't he?
Oh, my God.
He's just bumping all over the place. He can still bump.
I can't believe it. Bobby the Heenan asked for it.
And boy, I'll tell you, he got it.
Did you see what Patera did to him? He put the belt around and snapped him across the ring.
Look at that. Where? What an ovation. Keith Patera, Bobby the Brain Heenan. We'll be back as we continue. Stay with us.
Now,
I thought they... Why do I remember the bleeping part of that?
I don't remember that. I don't know, but...
Ken that bump was not smart.
No. Ken Patera to babyface, Pete. He was such a great heel. I mean, I understand why they did what they did, and it worked for a short time, but...
Wait, how do you understand the bringing him back after his...
Redemption. The story of redemption.
But it's not... Oh, he's redeeming himself. He's angry his manager didn't visit him while he was in prison for assault.
Yeah, but still, it's against Bobby Heenan. So,
sure.
Anyway, what do you think about Patera, the heel, or Patera the babyface? What was
your heel all the way? He's a natural arrogant. You know, like you talk about being an extension of yourself. You know,
that's
who he is. I guess I would imagine most of you guys have heard him talk or do a shoot interview or something like that. And that's a heel. You'd have to change a lot of who you are to be a babyface. Although I will say that back in the WWF days, he was kind of getting over as that, you know, he was so good and he could wrestle and he had the Olympic thing and all that, that I think had they done it on not the first run, but the earlier runs, he certainly was getting cheered in a lot of places and maybe not completely but certainly by a lot of fans when he was wrestling Bob Backlund or Paige Morales for sure.
Yeah.
And that's a different time. Now at this time, I definitely would not have gone babyface with him at all. Bring him back as a killer. Bring him back as a killer heel or something. You know, it was, you know what I mean, as a prison thing or something, if they had to bring that storyline in. But this didn't work. And it did for, like you said, a short time, but not in the long run. I don't think it ever worked in the long run.
No, and he had gotten a little like too light. You know, he didn't look like himself in a way, physically. And, you know. Speaking of newly turned babyfaces, also in this episode of Superstars, we have Brutus Beefcake going over Johnny V with the sleeper at 142. And after the match, Brutus shaved off part of Johnny V's hair as he laid unconscious. And this was Brutus's debut as the barber. And Vix, we have that.
Yes, by the way, amazing coincidence that all this stuff is happening on the first Superstars of May, isn't it?
Yeah, sweeps time.
Folks, as we promised you last week, we had this very special pre-recorded match that in fact took place last week between Brutus.
Oh, obviously it's on challenge.
Let's call him a traitor. That's what he is. Nobody likes a traitor.
Let's go to it.
That's what he is.
You know, Luscious Johnny V stated a long time ago that I determined that Brutus Beefcake was in fact the weak link, baby, and no doubt about it. Yes, I determined it a long time ago. And I'm going to tell you something. I'm so confident, Beefcake. I'm going to wrestle you here, right here, baby. And I'm so confident, I gave the Dream Team the night off.
I can't believe that. That's confidence, all right. Let's go up to ringside. What a matchup this is going to be.
The following bout is scheduled for one fall. Introducing from New York City.
All right, so we'll skip to the finish, I guess.
Yes, imagine only 2 minutes.
Well, the whole video is like five, though.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Is that a sleeper or a chokehold? Check where that forearm is under the chin. That looks like a chokehold to me.
Whatever it is, the referee's there to check. And Johnny V, I believe, is going nine-nine. Just like we saw Adrian Adonis go to sleep in WrestleMania.
That referee needs to get in and take a closer look at that. Is that a sleeper? Is that a chokeout?
Johnny V is going nine-nine. Brutus has just about hit. Brutus wins his punt. Was he gone? Brutus not even accepting the accolades of this capacity crowd. Wait a minute. Yes, he is, too.
He's not hanging around to be declared the winner.
Brutus outside. Wait a minute. What's he got there? He's putting on that barber smock. That's what he's doing.
He's back in there. What's he got in there? Clippers. He's, look at him. Brutus strutting about. Hey. We're going to talk about strutting and cutting here. Brutus.
Wait a minute. You're telling me the referee is going to allow this to happen, what I think is going to happen here?
Oh, my. Johnny V is being styled by the barber. Brutus.
This is outrageous. I can't believe this. Yeah, you laugh. I'd like to see you laying up there getting some kind of haircut like that. Oh, my
goodness. He did eventually.
Earlier on was strutting, and now he's doing his cutting, and Johnny V out of sleep. Imagine what's going to happen when Johnny V wakes up.
I'll tell you what's going to happen. Brutus Beefcake is going to have the new Dream Team on him.
Well, now do you think Johnny V made a big mistake? His confidence level was sky high, and I'm sure now he is sorry that he gave the new Dream Team the night off, so to speak. Look at that.
Oh, that Vince.
Ooh, that'll do it. Brutus Beefcake.
Here is your winner, Brutus the Barber Beefcake.
Hey, a Mel Phillips cameo. Amazing. Mel Phillips. Also on the episode of Superstars, we had these two matches. Killer Khan pinned Nelson Velu in 127, which is Khan's return after being gone for 5 years. And Adrian Adonis defeated Jake the Milkman Milliman. Why is Milkman working a show in Worcester, Mass? By submission in 110 with the sleeper. And Adonis' first and only appearance on television after being shaved bald at WrestleMania 3. More on why Adonis left later in the show. But Boston Garden was the big show this week on May the 2nd. Did they tell us he's live on Ness and Mix?
I believe so. I don't think there were any that weren't from once they started doing it till the end.
Okay, so this was live on Nessun, right before Saturday Night's Main Event. And 11,834 at Boston Garden, 148,776 house. For this card, and what a card this is. Nick Kaniski over Frenchie Martin. Oof. Demolition over the Islanders. Iron Mike Sharp over Stevie Afi. Hulk Hogan over King Harley Race in 9:17. With a roll-up after Race missed his diving headbutt. After the match, Race attacked Hogan as he was posing, bloodied him. And later on, Hogan returned to ringside and challenged Race to a Texas death match for next month's show and said if he couldn't beat Race, he would quit pro wrestling. That's an interesting promo for Hogan to cut in this era. And Hogan and Harley Race feud picks, very underrated.
Yeah, they had very good matches together, although they were often the same match, so.
Well, they were the same match, but it was fun for what it was. Sika over the Duke of Dorchester, Pete Doherty. Then we had Brutus over Johnny V, where he cut some of the hair again, and spray painted Johnny V. Ken Patera with Jake Roberts, who he was subbing for, pinned the Honky Tonk Man after Jake tripped Honky. During the match, Jimmy Hart was announcing, and after the match, Kim Patera applied the full Nelson to Honky, but was attacked from behind by Hart with a megaphone just as Roberts was getting Damien out of the bag. Hart Foundation over the Bulldogs by DQ. And that's the end of the show. Of the three shows, Biggs, Boston Garden Spectrum or MSG that aired on the networks, where would you have ranked the Boston shows? Because they were different their own way. Each one was different. But Boston had like this different vibe completely of the other two shows. When you say that,
they had the coolest look.
Yeah, they did have the coolest look.
Oh, that changed around this era.
Yeah, it was, and they had their own like announcing crew most of the time, and usually Pete Doherty was an announcer.
Well, that was mostly this era. That was mostly like 87, 88.
Yeah, so interesting shows, and I miss those days of. Watch a prime time and seeing matches from all the different arenas like this.
Maple Leaf Gardens.
Yeah. Half the matches. Yeah. Most of the early matches on this show was all on prime time. So, interesting stuff. All right, Adrian Adonis. Speaking of London, Adrian Adonis was fired after the London, Ontario show on April 27th and isn't likely he will be asked back, as the WWF has instituted a dress code recently and that they want their wrestlers to attend the shows wearing nice clothes, and Adonis is repeatedly violating the rules. There was also rumors that he was fired for other antics. Yeah, Adonis, Pete, I mean, if you watch Adonis in, like, same as that went out of the ring, Adonis was a guy who was always pretty much dressed up in shorts, tennis shoes, and a shirt. And I guess WWF was trying to be more professional this time, but it's kind of hard to ask the wrestlers in this era to go wear nice clothes, quote unquote, whatever that meant, into the building. I mean, what do you think about that rule? Or what do you think they were trying to find a way to get rid of some guys?
No, I think, in my opinion, it's kind of like that. You see it in with sports teams like Major League Baseball and stuff like that. They all have dress codes and that type of thing. And it just seemed like it was, I don't think it was aimed at anybody in particular. I just think that they were just trying to professional it up, so to speak. But in that era, when they're going all over the place and they're having a day off and, you know, flying all over and whatnot, you know, for people of our age, you know, it went away where, you know, people used to fly and they dress in a suit and tie.
Oh, you know, yes, that don't happen no more.
yeah, exactly. So, you know, you get people in there that believe in that stuff, and I don't know. I mean, I understand having discipline and things like that, and I'm a coach myself, but by the same token, that whole thing about the dress codes and all that, and especially when you're, you know, like I'm saying, those guys were on the planes constantly. They're going all over the place. And, you know, I can't imagine having to, you know, think about having to pack a suit somewhere and then you're constantly on the road. What are you going to do? So I don't believe it was aimed at anybody in particular. I think it was just someone that was a little bit old school or trying to put like some sort of professionalism or, you know, discipline mentality in there. I really don't think it was aimed at anybody. I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
And of course, Biggs, Adonis didn't take long to find work. He was in AWA right after this happened. So
yeah, started to gain a lot more weight though. I mean, he had gained a good amount of weight, but then he gained a lot more fast.
Yeah, and that's the thing with this era, too, is a lot of guys were able to do stuff like this because they'd know that these other promotions would snap them up more often than not. Case in point, Glad Jack Mulligan also quit, and now Ron Bassett now has no one to feud with. And, of course, Glad Jack Mulligan left and went back to work for Crockett in Florida. And then he would quit there in a couple months after that, after this. Mulligan's one of these guys. He would bounce in and out, and Florida Pete was always somewhere that Mulligan, he always, especially in the 80s, if whenever he would get somewhere where he needed to get out of work, he always needed Florida was the place he could go. But once Crockett bought Florida and shut it down, that's it. He couldn't do that no more.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know when, I mean, I've always heard the rumors about him having the heart attack or something. Maybe late 70s, early 80s. I'm not really sure exactly. But he used to really be able to move. And what I remember, I was driving through from Florida, New York one time and saw a match of his from Mid-Atlantic in the late 70s. And, man, you know, he did that. He threw the guy off the ropes and did the flying elbow, you know, meeting him mid-ring where he's like horizontal to the mat in the air, and he looked great. But by this time, here's this guy that his whole thing is brawling and all that, and I know he was stiff as a board, and I know he got real life fights and things, but he, for a guy that his whole gimmick is throwing punches, he threw the worst punches. I mean, it was just terrible. I mean, he was a big guy, but still, it just was bad. In any case, though, they homesteaded, and I believe they lived out by, as many did, the Tampa area, and he would just come back and always had it. But yeah, then, you know, this is the whole idea that everything's drying up. So where is there to go?
Yep. Now, Scott Casey is coming in soon, and Dave thinks that it would be a good idea for to team up with Sam Houston, the former Cowboy team, because he doesn't feel like they would get pushed as singles wrestlers. Bix? For those who don't know, Scott Casey will become a famous gigolo. And Scott Casey and Houston, they did okay, considering who they were in WWF, I guess. Wouldn't you say so?
I guess. I mean, they didn't really do much with Scott Casey. I guess say they actually did more with Sam Houston than they did with Scott Casey. Not yeah. that much with either. I guess Sam Houston.
In no offense to Scott Casey, but what are you going to do with them? You know, you're not going to have bloody brawls or anything in the WWF.
Yeah. But, you know. He's just a guy. And right before this, he was working in Continental. So, I mean, he wasn't really doing a whole lot before. So this is, you know, paying, you know, a steady paying gig for a while. And he worked there for going into 88. And well, in
88.
Yeah,
he so did he TV jobs, didn't he?
Yeah, he did TV jobs, but he would also he was like a good comparison, kind of like a Tim Horner type guy when Jim Horner was there. Jim Powers, guys like that. Aroma. Mm-hmm. He could work house shows and get wins.
SD Jones.
Yeah, get wins on house shows and stuff like that, but kind of like that credible jobber to the stars on television.
And if they ever needed a pro wrestler to on the roster to romance an older woman, he was right there.
Man, 2 short weeks of gigolos at the Buff Bagwell last week. I love this one. Fans are cheering Demolition in their series of matches against the Islanders on the house show, which has prompted talk about turning the Islanders heel. The reason why I think this is fun, and they did that eventually.
But it took a long time.
The Usos are getting booed out of the building, you know, these days a lot of the times. And of course, Roman Reigns. What is it about fans rejecting Samoans, Bix?
I don't think they're rejecting them because they're Samoan. I think they're rejecting them because they're aligned with Roman Reigns.
I know, but I'm just saying the Islanders were, you know.
The Islanders weren't that good as babyfaces, though. They improved a lot once they turned heel.
Yeah, but they weren't heel before, though. You know?
Sure.
I mean, I don't know. I just found that it is interesting to me how we're going through this again today with Samoan characters.
And with the nephews of one half of the Islanders.
Yeah. Biggest crowd of the week was at Nassau Coliseum, Vix's home turf, on May the 1st, where Ricky Steamboat beat Randy Savage in a cage match, which drew 15,275 and 159,207 gate. Pretty strong business there, Bix.
That's basically a full house at the Coliseum.
And this was the steel cage, you know, where you walked out the door and stuff like that. So.
Didn't they do, I think the finish they did around the horn was that Savage knocked Steamboat out of the cage.
Yes, yeah, Savage knocked him out of the cage. Yeah, that's the way he won the match.
Which is not, I don't get booking that as a finish for Steamboat to win, but okay. No. That's always been kind of a holy grail for me. I mean, it used to be for other people too, but you don't really hear about it much anymore. I think I used to hear a story that there were cameras at the show, like for the big screens and for the luxury box monitors and stuff, but it's not ever shown up. But I mean, we've seen occasionally WWF or WWE would use clips of house shows that weren't the usual, you know, televised house shows. Like occasionally you just randomly see something pop up, like in a
and from Nassau Coliseum
package. like when though? Like what do you think?
I'm trying to remember. I remember that they showed something from Nassau Coliseum one time. I just can't remember what.
Okay.
But anyway, to close our show on a sad note, on April 28, Barry Orton was hospitalized following a vehicle wreck near Tempe, Arizona. The wreck killed his passenger, Sherry Joe Bennett, of Livermore, California. And the next week, he was arrested in the hospital for vehicle homicide. And did he do any jail time off this, Bix? I can't remember.
I think he did, didn't he? Because then Vince started talking to him about it on Larry King.
Yeah. Bad deal here. Wasn't it drunk driving?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I would think if he was charged, it was drunk driving.
And Barry Orton's, you know, a guy, Pete, that really, really good little worker, but, you know, he wasn't his brother, put it that way. And I don't know. He was a little bit shorter.
Yeah, I think he was a little small, and I don't think they saw him, because I've heard from a lot of people. I didn't see it myself, but I did hear from a lot of people that when he did the whole Zodiac thing in Canada, that it was amazing.
Yes. You know, yeah, that was good to that. He had like a rebirth years later when he got out of jail.
When was it, though? Because I thought that started in 87.
Zodiac was in 88.
He didn't get there till 88?
Yeah.
Didn't Jason show up in 87, though?
Jason was there, yeah.
Jason was there already, but Zodiac didn't come till later?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought that was 87.
Obviously, I didn't see it, but that's how I was getting at it. It was amazing from what I heard, but they didn't see that. So, you know, what do you have? You're a small guy that isn't that over, and now he's got, like, legal problems, too. So it's unfortunate, because I heard that he could do that. I knew he could work. So, you know, he could have done more. I've heard from a lot of people that he could have been major if they would have... you know, listen to his interviews and let him fly a little bit.
And it's one of the all-time great, terrible Ed Whalen moments when he loses the mask match to Jason after they split. And Jason pulls the mask off him, and Ed Whalen's just like, I don't know him. I don't know what it is. And, you know, let's play a Jason, or a bit of a Zodiac promo for a second.
Fusions, anarchy, genocide, Armageddon, defeat! I suggest that all members of the so-called Heart Mafia, or Vice Busters, research the meanings of these words and study them well! Because while Jupiter, Mercury, and Mars align themselves to form my powers into their most hideous extreme, these words shall define your futures! Bruce Hart! Brian Pillman! Bad Company! That anonymous feeling of being watched constantly! The heat that follows behind you everywhere you go! Is the ascending spirit of the beast snipping at your heels! And soon! Soon its sharp dagger teeth shall sink into your flesh, ripping you to shreds! Corporal Kirshner, I suggest you don't let your overconfidence be the plight of your downfall!
That's amazing stuff right there. I mean, he could have worked Memphis with that gimmick. I mean, that'd been awesome in Memphis.
His dad actually did the Zodiac.
In Florida, yeah.
Late 60s, early 70s. So, God knows. I mean, I wasn't around then for those interviews. I moved down here in 76, but he was really good too. But, you know, Orton, I mean, find one that can't work or whatever, pretty hard. So,
wow.
Heck of a way to end the show, though, I got to say.
Oh, yeah. That's a revelation. I mean, I've watched Zodiac stuff, but. And Stampede, but I haven't really like delved into it in a long time. I totally forgot about those promo style. I need to turn him on to my good buddy Dan Wilson, Bix. Dan would love that stuff.
You need to send that to him right now.
It fits right into his character. But anyway, that's it for the show this evening. Pete, what have you had to plug this week?
Really not too much. I mean, this show obviously, and will definitely give me that tweet like you did last time, and people that follow me could do that. I'm really haven't been doing too much on Twitter, still on Facebook, and I have the Facebook page. It's called Pete Lederberg's Photos or something.
Good
like
stuff
that
on there.
It's easy enough to find. I actually was just putting up stuff from this huge show in at the end of April in 1978 that they had in St. Petersburg, where me and Harvey raced against Jack Briscoe, but Bob Backlund wrestled Ivan Koloff, superstar Billy Graham against the Spoiler, Andre the Giant was there, teaming with Mike Graham and Steve Kern and things like that. And, you know, I was there, Barry was there, my friend Brian was there, and Brian took all the pictures, but it's pretty amazing stuff. So I would definitely say, you know, come check that out. And I shared it with a bunch of the different pages on Facebook because, you know, if anybody wants it, just let me know, and I'm glad to do that.
Yeah, Pete, yeah, if you haven't been to Pete's photo page on Facebook, you really need to go there because this has got some tremendous photos of people from that era that you don't see a lot of photos from online, especially in that good of a quality. So, yeah, go check out those wrestling photos.
Thank you. Yeah, I have the actual negative, so it's not like I'm taking it from somewhere else. You know, it's directly from the negative.
And people can buy prints from you, too, if they want, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They do that. You know, it's all up there on the page. The list is there and how to order prints and all that. And, you know, I've always tried to be reasonable, and I always have gone by the same, treat people the way you want to be treated. So you can't find anybody I've ever ripped off because it hasn't happened. So.
And also,
unlike some of the wrestling people.
Yeah, and also the subgroup that's also, you know, involved in this is the Championship Wrestling from Florida.
Yeah, the Championship Wrestling from Florida Archives, it's called.
Go check that out. Barry Rose puts up tremendous stuff on there. It's a gold mine of classic wrestling photos, programs, all kinds of great stuff on there. Great, great stuff.
I'm looking right now. I don't know if I had seen this photo of Dusty's arm all carved up before.
Oh, yeah.
That's a sight.
Dusty's arm.
Oh, yeah. I've got pictures of Dusty bleeding from the arm as well in different matches. So
he loved doing that. Yeah. That was one of his favorite deals, Aaron.
Especially when he's wrestling someone with a claw, you know, like Pac Song or it's a spoiler.
Yeah, it's a good way to...
But if you want, I'll remember. I'll put some up for you.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to see over. I don't know if I want to see that over and over. But sure.
All right, Bix. What do we have to plug this week? What you got?
Oh, my God. Some of these. I'm just going through like a bunch that you would post at the same time of Bloody Dusty photos. They're gnarly. Okay. And... Oh my God. it's like that photo from the George Napolitano books where his face is just completely splattered in blood.
Yeah.
Now imagine seeing that over and over and over. All right, this week 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com. We've got the sequel to the Michael Hayes stuff that went up the week before WrestleMania. Week before WrestleMania, we had audio of a Michael Hayes interview from Dallas Radio from 1984. This week, we've got from 1988 when he was plugging the concert that he had at the Dallas Sportatorium, which, of course, they did a big angle with and all that. So that's on there. Plus, he's newly single at the time of this interview. So just note his reactions when women call up versus when men call up on that radio appearance. Tom Robinson back for another Dennis of the Week with him, talking about the NWA Grand Slam shows in Minnesota in 93 and various related items to those, including some amazing, amazing impressions from Tom. Including people who you never would have thought to do an impression of, or for anyone to do an impression of, but it's uncanny. Just so.
He's got, hey, the dude's talented, man. I was listening to that and I'm like, wow, this is just amazing.
I'll just say is, he does a Sabu impression, and who would have ever thought to do a Sabu impression?
Yeah, because he didn't talk. I mean, you could only do the impression like if you like was around him and listened to him talk.
Or shoot. I mean, late now there are the shoot interviews.
Oh, yeah, but
even then, he's only got a couple of those.
Yeah.
And what else do we've got? We've got part one of our interview with John Arezzi talking about his... Yeah, not talking about his radio show as much yet in the first part. We've got stuff about his early days in and around wrestling, like running Freddie Blassie's fan club, dealing with Mike Lano, pre-dentistry.
Dr.
And some amazing stories on there. Well, he's not Dr. Michael Anno when this happened.
I know.
And including a certain wrestling photographer, not the one on the line, who once punched Mike in the face.
I'm sure he deserved it.
And other stuff like
that. Yeah, I never did that.
Did you want to, Pete?
I've never done it. I swear I haven't. You know, not that I was never tempted to, actually, you know. But, well, no, you know, that never tempted in person. Let me rephrase that. Okay.
And, so with John, though, also when he talked his way into working WWF squash matches against Dusty Rhodes and Peter Maivia, and also starting the Modern Wrestling Fan Convention, all that in part one this week. And also we've got What If, about what if one of the non-AWA promotions in the running got the ESPN time slot for wrestling in 85, plus all sorts of other stuff. That is at 605pod.com. Otherwise, I guess, I don't know, I'll plug that I have, for those who care, I have a new Hogan Gawker thing up at Death and Taxes.
No.
I know you're shocked.
I am just flabbergasted.
That Hogan Gawker stuff got me the Death and Taxes gig, so what do you expect?
I know, hey. You did great. Very worth doing it. It's just interesting that you're still doing it.
Well, as long as there's still stuff there and they want me to do it, then I guess I'm going to keep doing it. And I guess that's it for now. Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Chris, what do you got? Do we got... Well, I guess, is the Premier Podcast brand going to continue to exist? Or is there an exile coming? Or well, we've got... By the time this is up, I know you're going to have a post-payback roundtable.
Yeah, a reaction show. Payback reaction show will be up on the Place to Be Nation, so go check that out. Interested to see how that show is going to go. It has potential to be a really good wrestling show, but curious to see how the finishes go and the big angle with the McMahons. So go check that out.
And there's probably going to be, and there's going to be a big angle in the main event, I would think, too.
Yeah. Premier Podcast brand will probably return whenever the tag team section of the Greatest Wrestler Ever Project comes up in May. So, be on the lookout for that when that happens. Exile on Bad Street. We're trying to get a set up on the recording date for the next show. Make sure everybody's in the same line so we can get it knocked out. Discussing Continental Championship Wrestling Part 3. We'll be going from July 87 to June 88 on that show, which a lot of stuff's going on in that time period. And, of course, Between the Sheets every Monday. And I'll go ahead and tell you what next show is going to be. Bix, this is always a surprise to Bix, too, whenever I do this.
Well, not always.
Not always. But, well, the past couple times it's been, actually, I think. But we will be going back to the 90s, 1993 this time. And that week is headlined by a couple of things. We have the Wrestling Dontaku show with Hulk Hogan.
First annual back. Wrestling Dontaku, right?
Yep. Coming back into New Japan. And Atsushi Onita, Terry Funk, barbed wire explosive match going on that week. Also, Volunteer Slam 2.
Week.
Volunteer Slam 2 is that week. And a lot of comings and goings in the promotion. So a packed week that week. So, be on the lookout next week, and guest-wise, we'll figure it out when we figure it out. So,
is this the most loaded show Japan-wise we've had so far?
Probably, because UWFI is going on, and I mean, it's a lot going on that week. So yeah, it's gonna be a good Japanese week for sure. So if you love Japanese pro wrestling, then that show's for you. At Chris Zellner, KRISZELLNER on Twitter. So go check that out from my musings and whatever. NFL draft's over, so you don't have to hear about that for another year. Other than that, I think that's everything we got going this week. Hopefully next week we will have more drops, as I've been getting requests for drops lately on Twitter. The feature on this show, Bix is waiting to get fully registered before he can use his board.
Well, I was doing the trial, and then I buy it, and it's been like a week, and I still haven't gotten my registration code. So I,
yeah, so he's waiting
I
on
may
his
have to deal with PayPal when it comes.
So we're gonna once we get that settled, expect to hear more drops on the show. And we'll try to mix it up a little variety, so you won't hear dun 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 all the time. Although that's always going to be in the rotation. But if you have any requests for drops, let me know, or let Bix know, and we'll add them to the mix. We'll be like all these other wacky, sports radio type shows, or your wacky FM morning shows, the morning zoo
type.
Does
that mean I need like a wacky horn that I honk?
Yeah. Need that and. What else you need? You need like a clown laughing or some crazy stuff like that. Oh, there you go.
Or Jamie Dundee laughing.
Or Jamie Dundee laughing. Close enough. All right. It's time to go. So thank you for listening. And this is hold on. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, folks. So it's late.
Well,
thanks, Pete, for being on the show with us.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on. And
we'll definitely have you back
as
in the future.
Great man once said, so long from the Sunshine State.
And so long from the Peach State of Georgia. Thanks, Bix.
He's a guy with values. He's a family man. Loves his wife and son and does the best.